Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
What are you talking about?
That's right. We're moving to Mississippi, and you know how that's spelled. M-I, crooked letter, I. Crooked letter, I.
In 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act. That legislation was aimed at helping African Americans exercise their right to vote. But that law didn't end voter suppression. Throughout the South, white segregationists continued to find ways to keep blacks from voting and participating freely in civic life. That same year, the federal government began the Head Start program as a way to improve education for children in poor families, part of President Johnson's war on poverty. In Mississippi, a group of civil rights activists decided to combine Head Start with voting rights. The collaboration came through an organization called the Child Development Group of Mississippi. The program not only gave black children access to early education, it also employed working-class black Mississippians and gave them the freedom to vote without fear of losing their jobs. A new book examines the origins of the Child Development Group of Mississippi. The book is called A Chance for Change, Head Start, and Mississippi's Black Freedom Struggle. And joining me now is Crystal Sanders, the author of the book and a professor of history and African American studies at Penn State University. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Tuesday, but on with me now on the state of things. Crystal Sanders, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
We should take one step back and talk about the war on poverty a little bit, because I think if people know anything about it, they know this is a way to sort of spend money, a way to just alleviate poverty through federal programs and federal spending. But it also empowered people locally at the grassroots to organize around how that money would be spent. And I think that's critical to understanding what you're talking about in this book. So if you can give us that context, it would be helpful.
Sure. Well, in 1964, in his State of the Union address, President Lyndon Johnson asked Congress for legislation that would allow the country to wage an unconditional war on poverty. That call became the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. And the Economic Opportunity Act had several titles. It created a wide range of programs, including things like Job Corps, Work Study, and VISTA. Title II of the Economic Opportunity Act was the Community Action Program, and the authorizing legislation for the Community Action Program said that programs that were funded under Title II had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor. And what this meant is that working-class individuals would have a role to play, significant, meaningful roles to play in the administration and operations of programs that were to serve them.
I'm going to take a half a step back here and remind our listeners here in North Carolina that that idea was patterned on what then Governor Terry Sanford created, which was called the North Carolina Fund, that did exactly that, the idea that you would empower local people to decide on how that money would be spent. Lyndon Johnson actually called Terry Sanford and said, "I understand you've got a program going on in North Carolina. Sounds like something I want to be interested in." So I just wanted to point that out. But this is key to understanding the basis and the essence of your book. Tell us then how the pushback and reaction to the Voting Rights Act and Head Start came together to create a real freedom movement in Mississippi.
Well, first, I should say that Head Start was not one of the original programs authorized by the Economic Opportunity Act in 1964. But The Office of Economic Opportunity creates Head Start in 1965 after learning that half of all poor people in the United States were under the age of five. So Head Start was created as a way of improving the educational opportunities for young kids as a way of hopefully preventing them from living lives in poverty. So in 1965, Head Start is funded under the Community Action Program, which meant, as a community action program, that Head Start had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor. When we go to a place like Mississippi, we know that even after 1965, life had not really changed for working class African Americans. So in 1964, President Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. But what we see in Mississippi is that many business owners actually closed their businesses rather than comply with desegregation of facilities. We know that after President Johnson signs the Voting Rights Act in 1965, we see that in Mississippi, it would be a year after that legislation is enacted before federal voter registrars enter the counties with the worst histories of black disfranchisement. It's in 1966, a year after the Voting Rights Act, that Vernon Damer, a black man in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, is killed by Klansmen because he's encouraging African Americans to register to vote. So what this tells us is that working class black Mississippians were looking for ways to give the civil rights legislation of 1964 and 1965 real meaning in their lives. And they decided that Head Start might just be the avenue that they should pursue for full freedom. And the reason they were so attracted to Head Start was because, again, this was a community action program that said it had to be operated with the maximum feasible participation of the poor.
So, we should point out that direct intimidation is one of the suppression efforts, but other efforts included the threat of being fired from your job if you voted, right? I mean, this becomes
exactly.
a serious threat.
Exactly. And so because of this maximum feasible participation clause, what that meant was that local people had the opportunity to secure Head Start employment. This would mean that, first of all, they would be making more money than they had made previously, where most working class blacks in the state have been working as domestics or as cotton shoppers. It also meant that now they were not going to be employed by local people in the community, by local whites in the community. So this meant they had the financial freedom to be more politically active. It means they have the financial freedom to vote without the fear of economic reprisal. They have the financial freedom to send their kids to previously all-white schools and not have to be concerned about losing their jobs. So Head Start gives them another avenue to pursue the very things they have been trying to pursue for decades.
And there was opposition to Head Start itself, and that was pretty violent in some cases. Tell us about the opposition to Head Start.
Exactly. Well, to understand the opposition to Head Start in Mississippi, we have to understand the long history of black education in that state. And dating back to the Reconstruction era, white supremacists had attempted to control, limit, and filter what black kids learned. But CDGM's program was untraditional in that Head Start teachers taught their students black history. They taught their students West African history. They taught their students to speak up, to ask questions, to assert themselves. And there were many white supremacists who found this type of curriculum to be quite dangerous. So what we see is that when these CDGM Head Start centers begin their operations in 1965, Klansmen burn certain centers to the ground. Knight Riders shoot into centers regularly. We see teachers of these centers harassed by policemen on trumped-up traffic violations. All of these types of violent reprisals and economic reprisals were supposed to weaken CDGM's program. Now, despite all of this opposition, I argue in the book that the most potent opposition came from Senator John C. Stennis. And John Stennis was the junior senator from the state of Mississippi. He served alongside James Eastland, but Stennis served on both the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee. If you know anything about the way our Senate works, that means he was in a very powerful position because sitting on the Senate Appropriations Committee, he had control over the budgets for the war on Vietnam and the war on poverty. And he's able to use his political clout to discredit CDGM's program time and time again.
and essentially come up with an alternative. We should point out CDGM, of course, is the Child Development Group of Mississippi that's essentially embodied to administer the Head Start program. So talk about his response to that and developing an alternative program.
Yes. Yeah, so Senator Stennis initially questioned the financial records of CDGM. So essentially he would make the argument that there was economic malfeasance, or that these people were in some way using money for illegal purposes. But when he calls for all of these audits, every single audit typically cleared these Head Start employees. It showed that for the most part, they were managing every single dime to the T. And these were multi-million dollar grants that working class Black Mississippians were winning and were allocating and were using to educate their kids. So once the charges of economic malfeasance don't stick, he begins to question the qualifications of the teachers themselves. Because in Head Start's initial years, teachers were not required to have formal credentials. So he begins to say, you know, the women who are working in these classrooms don't have the qualifications necessary to offer these kids quality early childhood education. Now, I found that to be very interesting that Stennis becomes concerned about the quality of education offered in these Head Start centers when he had never before expressed any concern about Black education in the state of Mississippi. So this is a newfound interest that he has. We also see that he is not just making these allegations in Senate speeches, but he is in close contact with Sergeant Shriver, who's the director of the War on Poverty, director of the Office of Economic Opportunity. And he's telling Sergeant Shriver, I want this program defunded. I want to see a new program that's run by responsible people, that's run by Mississippians. And that's his way of that's coded language to suggest that things aren't being done the way they're supposed to be done in the state. And that's true. Mississippi had never really before given working class blacks the opportunity to control anything other than their churches.
Well,
was something new,
right,
for Stennis.
Fascinating that he would say, Mississippians, there is no more grassroots program. It can't be any more grassroots in Mississippi. But of course, for him, Black people aren't Mississippians. What he means in coded language, and I guess what they mean today when they say real Americans, is white people.
Exactly. And remember, this argument about outsiders, right, or outside agitators had a long history when it came to civil rights in the South.
But I want to
point
out,
there was always this belief that local African Americans had to be content with their situation. So whoever was trying to change things or to challenge the racial status quo had to be an outsider.
But the money's coming from the outside, but the people running it are definitely from local communities.
Exactly. Indeed, these are Black Mississippians who are his constituents. So he should get to know them. He should have gotten to know them, and he should have known that they indeed were Mississippians, just as the people that he wants to operate Head Start in the state were also Mississippians, but they were white Mississippians. They were middle class Mississippians.
Interestingly enough, it was defunded, CDGM, in 1968. And again, this was, I think, the political wrangling with Sergeant Shriver, who was, as you say, the head of the program at the time, and who had to worry about where his funding was going to come from if Stennis was opposed to him.
Exactly.
So what does this say? I mean, I think there's a larger narrative that perhaps people misunderstand about why the war on poverty ended. Some people say it failed. But I think this whole question of empowerment and grassroots power was one of the elements that gets lost in the picture. And I wonder how you see the war on poverty and its legacy and what this story says about that legacy.
Well, unfortunately, the dominant narrative that surrounds the war on poverty is one of failure. It was this idea that the United States attempted to wage a war on poverty and poverty won. Remember, that's what President Ronald Reagan says in his own State of the Union address in the 1980s. We also see these arguments that the war on poverty created big government, or it created a culture of dependency among working class Americans. But really, I hope that those who read my book will begin to think differently about the war on poverty, especially in Southern communities that had histories of abject poverty and histories of very poor race relations. Because what we see is that CDGM ends not because of funding. It ends not because The workers did not have the qualifications to administer a federal program, but it ends because it was too successful at challenging the status quo. It was too successful at giving working class black Mississippians a seat at decision-making tables. And it's because it was so successful in changing the way things were typically done that the white power structure worked consistently to kill this program. And so, indeed, we have to rethink these narratives that surround war on poverty programs. We have to rethink the idea that they did not work or that they could not work. Because when we look at a program on the ground like CDGM, we see that it allowed working class black Mississippians like Roxy Meredith, the mother of James Meredith, or Pap Hamer, the husband of Fannie Lou Hamer, to secure well-paying jobs outside of the white power structure, well-paying jobs that allowed them to continue the civil rights activity that they had been doing for years, but activity that had been in some ways curtailed because of economic intimidation and economic reprisals.
Crystal Sanders, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Crystal Sanders' new book is called A Chance for Change, Head Start, and Mississippi's Black Freedom Struggles.
Anyone ever been down south? So you guys know what I'm talking about. And the racism down there is just fucking hot. Perfect. Stewed to a perfection. It's comfortable. It's out in the open. There are no secrets in Mississippi. Everybody knows the deal.
There's no reason you would ever come to Shibuda, Mississippi. Maybe a wrong turn south out of Meridian would put you here. There's no plaque or memorial to tell you of the bitter American history here along the Chickasaw River. And if you try, you can't even get to the place where it all happened. Some of the locals know about it, but nobody in this town of 430 will give you a tour. Poet Langston Hughes knew about it. "Oh, tragic, bitter river," he wrote, "where the lynched boys hung. The gall of your bitter water coats my tongue. The blood of your bitter water for me gives back no stars. I'm tired of the bitter river, tired of the bars." The bars he refers to are perhaps from the rickety old iron bridge behind a padlocked fence on private property now, a bridge that was once a place for white vigilantes to hang blacks and then dump their bodies into what legend said was a bottomless pit beneath the river. There are six documented lynchings that took place here, two men and two pregnant women in 1918 and two teenage boys in 1942, casualties in the war that eventually brought down the white supremacist government in the state of Mississippi.
I was a graduate student at Yale University. I was in the basement looking at microfilm of old newspapers, and there was an account of the 1942 lynchings of two adolescent boys, Ernest Green and Charlie Lang, that was actually a story covered in a New York left-leaning daily. It was called PM, and PM covered civil rights and race issues relatively early and honestly for a white publication, and they sent a journalist named Victor Bernstein down there. And one of the things that was in his story was a shot of the bridge.
Everyone involved remains trapped in a history that they often feel more than they know. That's a line from Jason Ward's book, Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence in America's Civil Rights Century. He believes America's history of racial violence is largely history that is felt but not known. It remains coded in anger that rubs out the facts. In the small rural Mississippi town of Shibuda in Clark County, there are six documented lynchings. Two young men and two pregnant women in 1918 expunged from the historical record except for the horrible memories that could never be forgotten. And then the 1942 lynching of two young boys on the very same hanging bridge over the Chickasaw River. The bridge has no name, but it is a memorial to brutality, to denial, and to the idea that murders like this can just fade away like a slowly rusting bridge. Why is the hanging bridge in Shibuda, Mississippi still standing? For Jason Ward, that was perhaps the biggest mystery of all.
Running across the 1942 story first meant that any honest journalist was going to quickly point out that this had been the site of a quadruple lynching 24 years before, at another time of world war and racial conflict in the United States. And so the first thing that hit me was the longer story of this site about race and civil rights in the 20th century.
How much did people know about those lynchings, particularly the first ones, which are especially gruesome?
One of the big challenges was 1918, because this was an event that was deliberately obscured and explained away by a media that was local, that was interested as much in protecting the racial status quo and taking white authorities' word for what had happened. So this story would have been impossible if Walter White, who had just gone to work for the NAACP less than a year before, was a fair-complexioned, fair-featured African-American, blonde hair, blue eyes. And this was the third time that he infiltrated a Southern community and investigated a lynching posing as a white man. He was able to give us those events. And because people thought he was white, he became very adept at working both sides of the tracks, both sides of town. He could sit down with white NAACP officials, of whom there were many, particularly at the outset, and also sit down with a white private detective that they hired out of Birmingham, who started asking around at their request about the murdered white man whose deaths sparked the arrest of these four employees of his, and then their eventual lynching.
And the details that he unearthed were legends, were like known in the fabric of these communities, particularly the African-American community. It was just terrorized. Can you describe the detail that went along with these lynchings?
The framing of the report is very important. This was 5 weeks after Armistice Day, but this was still the World War I era. And so it's framed as an indictment of American hypocrisy and white supremacy. This is what democracy looks like on the ground in Mississippi. So he was responding directly to the president, the first Southern-born president since the Civil War, and the ways in which they were glossing over and ignoring racial abuse. He was also telling a story that for him was primarily about sexual abuse and exploitation. So two of the victims were young black women, both of whom were pregnant. What Walter White was very eager to point out was that when you asked around town, people believed the father to be their white employer. So Walter White was peeling back not just the racial hypocrisy, but the sexual hypocrisy of blaming lynchings primarily on African-American men lusting after white women. He's really flipping that story. And who better to flip that myth than a man who claims his African-American heritage, but who can pass as white?
And the memories of people at the time include the evidence that the babies were alive in the mothers as they were dangling from this bridge. There was no way to eradicate those memories once you saw that. All of that stayed as part of this terror myth that lived on after the lynchings in 1918, right?
Correct. And that's where the third part of the story comes in, and that's that there was a quadruple lynching in 1918. There was a double lynching in 1942, both in the Jim Crow era. And then the question that I asked was, what does a community like this look like? What transpires? What doesn't transpire in the civil rights era? And what I found was that the movement arrives and really develops somewhat late. 1966 is really the climax of that story, but it's a story that involves racial violence, and it's a story that involves the memory of racial violence. So the story of the fetuses wriggling in the bellies is actually a story that a local African-American woman tells a war on poverty organizer who comes to the community to try to set up Head Start programs for black preschoolers. And she's asking why the community seems so hesitant to stick their necks out at all, signing on with a controversial federal program that local whites saw as a way around their control of welfare and education and school funding. So she literally tells this story of, you know, a long time ago, these folks were lynched. They lynched pregnant women, and you could see these babies wriggling in their bellies. She tells that story to a white, civil rights sympathizing, anti-poverty organizer who's asking, why didn't more people show up for this planning meeting? And that's powerful. That's significant.
Do you think that Mississippi was a white supremacist nation that was alive and well in the United States in the 20th century for many, many decades?
I use the term white supremacist regime because white supremacy was a political goal and a political project, and it was the way in which politics was conducted and government was operated. One of the threads that I think ties the whole story together is actually economics. There's real economic anxiety in the World War I era, in the World War II era, and certainly in the 1960s, and it has to do with whites' perceptions that suddenly African Americans have new economic opportunities, they are more mobile, they are more connected because of the growth of the NAACP and the growing reach of the black press. So there's this real sense that in times when there seems to be economic opportunity, that's always connected to political opportunity. And it's always connected to this real fear that society can flip on its head rather quick. And that's a lesson that went all the way back to the Reconstruction era that followed the Civil War.
The bridge itself, how did you feel when you saw it the first time?
There's certainly moments, and I've had several of them in this project, where the history really hits you. You know, saying the names out loud. That's seeing a physical site which has survived and persisted to this day. And then also seeing the echoes of these types of crimes and this culture of racial violence in the present.
Jason Ward, author of Hanging Bridge, Racial Violence in America's Civil Rights Century.
Tennessee. This week, Memphis is commemorating a grim chapter in its history, a 150-year-old atrocity that shocked the nation at the time. It was nearly forgotten, in part because of the language used to describe it. Christopher Blank of member station WKNO reports.
A somber procession began yesterday in the courtyard of the former Lorraine Motel. This is where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in 1968. Everyone here knows about that piece of history. But until recently, this part of town was virtually silent on what happened in 1866.
This year, we have called their names, we have heard their plight, we've listened to the stories, and we have righted this wrong.
For Keith Norman, president of the Memphis NAACP, that wrong of history went deeper than not knowing about it. It was also about how it would finally be remembered. Historian Stephen V. Ash says newspapers of the era labeled what happened here a race riot, mostly on the basis that it began as a fight between black Union soldiers and some Irish police officers.
The rumor among the whites was that this was a full-scale black uprising in South Memphis.
The police called for reinforcements.
And so white mobs began forming, marched into South Memphis, and began indiscriminately shooting down black men, women, and children.
This went on for 36 hours.
The toll was approximately 46 black people dead, many others savagely beaten, several women raped, all the black schools and churches in the city, all of them burned to the ground, along with almost 100 black homes. Yeah, it was a scene of devastation in South Memphis.
This mob attack would shape the course of Reconstruction-era politics and help speed the passage of the Constitution's 14th Amendment, guaranteeing citizenship to recently freed slaves.
My name is Phyllis Aluko, and I am an attorney.
Aluko read Ash's book, which is titled A Massacre in Memphis, the race riot that shook the nation 1 year after the Civil War. She couldn't believe she'd never heard about the incident, so she started the process of creating a historical marker. She got the local chapter of the NAACP to sponsor and pay for it. Then she submitted the application to the Tennessee Historical Commission.
I was so naive.
She didn't expect a months-long debate over what to name the violence. The commission wanted race riot at the top of the sign. But that phrase had other connotations for historian Beverly Bond of the University of Memphis.
Most people tend to think in a 20th century frame of reference that this must be African Americans who are rioting and destroying their communities.
Bond and others suspected a different kind of history was at play in this debate over words.
Naming is very important. If your name is John, and I insist on calling you Johnny, it's really a power relationship.
In an email to the NAACP, one commissioner said that the term race riot would, quote, stand the test of time. Not necessarily, says Beverly Robertson. When she was director of the National Civil Rights Museum, she found that it wasn't just the exhibits that needed routine maintenance. It was the language and scholarship of history itself.
If we don't tell it right, then generations to come will not understand what literally did happen.
Robertson is one of three African Americans on the 24-member Tennessee Historical Commission. The words race riot didn't sit well with her either, but she and others were outvoted. So when the commission finally insisted that those words appear on the sign, Robertson told the NAACP to pull the plug.
It's an important marker. We need to acknowledge and recognize that. And there's more than one way to skin a cat.
So instead, they put up a private marker with the city's blessing and not the state of Tennessee's. Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, says there's a growing choir of voices demanding a reconsidered history of the former Confederacy, starting with public monuments. Stevenson believes the South should remember the story of slavery and its aftermath in the way Germany now marks the Holocaust.
Until we change the landscape with these markers and with these images and with a new iconography, we're going to be living in a space that is compromised by the absence of truth.
At the end of Sunday's procession, civic leaders, pastors, police officers, and historians took pictures with one of the country's first memorials to a Reconstruction era event, a simple historic marker which states, in no uncertain terms, that the African Americans killed here in 1866 died not in a riot, but in a massacre. For NPR News, I'm Christopher Blank in Memphis.
My mother was pregnant with me while she was in prison. She was her own attorney, never been to law school. She was facing 300 and something odd years. One black woman pregnant beat the case. Mm-hmm. That just goes to show you the strength of a black woman and the strength of the oppressed.
Today, Afeni Shakur Davis, the mother of one of hip-hop's most significant figures, Tupac, died at the age of 69. Up next, we honor her spirit and legacy by airing a speech she gave in 2008 at the Green for All's The Dream Reborn Conference held in Memphis, Tennessee. Stay tuned.
Let me do this. How many people in here know someone who's committed suicide? Please raise your hand. I beg you to. Is anybody looking? Is anybody my age looking? Because when you used to ask that question, you didn't see that many hands, did you? Oh, no. Are you paying attention? Do you know what it means when someone is so hopeless? So hopeless that they are taking their lives. I'm going to challenge you. You ain't, don't worry about pollution. If we not living, it ain't nothing there. The rest of that don't matter. Because I tell you the truth, if I'm going to die anyway, I don't care about the pollution. I only care about the pollution if you promising me a world. Do you understand that? Oh, that's the truth.
Sandra Bland, say a name. Sandra Bland, say a name. Sandra Bland, say a name. Sandra Bland, won't you say a name? Say a name, say a name, say a name, say a name.
What happened to Sandra Bland? It's a question that troubled many people since the 28-year-old woman was found hanged in a Houston jail cell last July. Ms. Bland's death occurred just 3 days after she was stopped by a Texas state trooper for failing to signal a lane change, and that gave rise to murder charges, conspiracy theories, and fueled a national debate over the treatment of African Americans by white law enforcement officers. Debbie Nathan has examined the circumstances surrounding Ms. Bland's death and takes an in-depth look at her life as well in a story just published in The Nation. Nathan is an award-winning journalist, editor, and translator, and is the author of 4 books. I'm pleased that she can join us in our studio today. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
Debbie, there have been a lot of people who have died in police encounters, a lot of African-Americans. It's hard to keep track. Why do we continue to talk about Sandra Bland?
I think mainly because she came out of the world like a comet, because there are no other victims of brutality that I know of who left this incredibly rich, beautiful record of their lives on social media. She maintained for several months a Facebook page complete with smartphone videos that she would put up about once a week, that where she talked about things that were on her mind. And she was just a really charming person. She was a beautiful young woman, and that comes out not only in her image but in her voice and even in her postings, which a lot of times are just kind of funny and smart. And she left herself behind. I don't know how many people would have known her, ironically enough, if she had not died. But once she did die, people went to her page, and I think they were just devastated because they fell in love with her, but she wasn't here anymore. And I think that that is what's really made her very unique and very powerful. She is a fully human person.
Let's talk a little about the circumstances of her death. It's been almost a year since she died. Remind us, if you could, how she ended up in jail, and just as a result of a routine traffic stop, she ended up dead.
She had just come out of her alma mater's campus, which is in a little town in Texas. It's a black town. And she made a lane change without signaling, and she was stopped by a state trooper. And I kind of think of her in a way as maybe the Emmett Till of the epoch for down there, because she had Illinois license plates on her car when she was stopped. And I don't think that this would have ever happened to her in Illinois. She did not defer to this trooper in the way that Southern women are supposed to defer. And that's my opinion based on having grown up there. She didn't say, "Oh, officer, I'm so sorry," which is really what you're supposed to do. Instead, she was just civil. She wasn't friendly, but she certainly wasn't unfriendly, and she was just civil, and she was just kind of, he asked her what was wrong. She didn't seem all deferential and cheerful, and she answered his question, and I think just the fact that she told him she was a little irritated, but go on and do his job, he took offense at that. He made this snarky demand on her that was not a lawful demand. He just made this demand in a nasty tone of voice that she put her cigarette out. And then she asked him, "Why do I have to do that?" And all of a sudden, he went from about 0 to 100, and she followed him. And it turned into a very, very, very angry altercation. And, of course, he had the upper hand and threatened her with a taser and pulled her out of the car. And by the time it was over, she had scratches and bruises on her back. He shoved her to the ground. And he arrested her and charged her with felony assault on a public official.
And the video of that confrontation between Ms. Bland and Brian T. Encinia, he's the Texas State Trooper who stopped her. It went viral after it was released. He was placed on administrative duty after her death, and in January he was charged with perjury in connection with the case. How exactly did he perjure himself?
He filled out his form, whatever you need to fill out after you make an arrest, and he said that she had become combative after he lawfully tried to get her out of the car so that he could enforce a safe traffic stop. And so that's what he wrote. And if there had been no video, of course there was his video and then someone else made a video, it's just very clear from these videos that he didn't take her out to enforce a safe traffic stop. As the grand jury said, he took her out because he was just pissed off, which is not professional by any means.
And where do you think stand with the indictment?
He was just in court yesterday pleading innocent. And so eventually he will be judged, but right now, he was indicted. And I think he's going to go to trial. He just pleaded innocent.
What are the various charges? Is it just perjury?
He only has that misdemeanor. It's a misdemeanor charge, the perjury charge. That's it. He doesn't have any other charges.
Has anybody else been charged in connection with her death?
No other people have been charged.
She was born in 1987. She was raised by her mother, Geneva Reed, along with four sisters. So there are five of them. Where did she grow up?
She spent her first 9 years on the near west side of Chicago, which was a very beleaguered place by the time she was born. She was actually in the same neighborhood that Alex Kotlowitz wrote about in his book, There Are No Children Here. Very poverty-stricken, very violent by the time she was a young child, very segregated, and just a very bad place for children. And so her mother moved out to the suburbs, which was a pretty pioneering move because she went to DuPage County, which is a bordering county where only at the time 4% of the population was black. So she took the kids out to this quiet little suburb.
And you said it was overwhelmingly white high school that she went attended.
Yeah, again, it was about 3 or 4% black, and everybody else was not black. Yeah, primarily white.
But one thing that's great about your article in The Nation is you give us a sense of she's an extremely talented girl growing up. She has all these different extracurricular activities she's involved with. Tell me about some of those.
You know, I think I was talking to somebody out there, to someone who went through that high school experience, also black, who said that, you know, this is what you do if you're in a situation like that. I mean, what are you going to do? You're either going to try to hide or you're going to try to stick out. And she did the latter, and she was a wonderful student, and she was in the Honor Society, and she joined practically every curricular, extracurricular activity and club that there was. She was in the symphony band. She played the trombone. She was a very tall young woman. And so that fit her, that instrument. She was in, I think, student government, and she was in, like, the Model UN, and she was in this club and that club and athletics and basketball and, you know, the Foreign Language Honor Society. I mean, you just couldn't even count them on two hands.
So she has great promise, and eventually she decides to go to college down in Texas.
She was. She was a very bright young woman, and obviously a very ambitious young woman. I think that her family encouraged that greatly. And she went to, I believe, a college recruiting fair, and she was very taken by the idea of going to a historically black college university, an HBCU, which is what Prairie View University or Prairie View A&M is. It's a college in Texas. And Prairie View happens to be kind of the pioneer developer of the drumline and the black marching band, which is like an incredible phenomenon with really amazing showmanship and amazing music. And there was a professor, a band professor, who had come in and decided that he really wanted to make this the champion band. So he started a scholarship program, and she got in on that trombone, you know, on her trombone into a music scholarship program with that band.
And this other side of her life, you know, she's this tough young thing, but she eventually starts making these videos that give us a window into who she was, and I guess really humanized her in the eyes of all the people who have been mourning her death. And I'd like to play one of these videos. What was it called? Sandra Speaks? Is that the name of the...
She called her entire project Sandy Speaks. Sandy Speaks.
Right. Mm-hmm. So let's play one of these clips that speaks to her, I guess, her state of mind.
It is March 1st, 2015. I want to first of all say I apologize. I am sorry, my kings and queens. It's been 2 long weeks and I have been missing in action. But I gotta be honest with you guys. I am suffering from something that some of you all may be dealing with right now. It's a little bit of depression as well as PTSD. I've been real stressed out over these past couple of weeks, but that does not excuse me not keeping my promise to you all by letting you know that somebody cares about you, someone loves you, and that you can go out there and do great things. But I want you guys to know that I'm a human. And so if there are any of you that are dealing with these same things, depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, it's okay.
So she puts it out there. She makes herself very vulnerable to all these followers. How did people respond to this revelation about her mental illness?
You know, it's so brave. I mean, I listen to it and I think, God, she was so brave, because she didn't do that just once. She did that twice. She talked about her depression twice. Orally, right, you know, on these videos. And she posted articles in her Facebook where she just did her links and discussions. And she posted articles about African-American women and depression. And she said, you know, this is a really serious problem. This is an issue. And it's a serious problem. As she said, we don't talk about this in African-American culture. Those are her words. That's her speaking. And there are many reasons for that, which are probably too long to get into on this show, many cultural and historical reasons why it's difficult to talk about these kinds of problems. But it just seemed like nobody was listening when she talked on her Sandy Speaks, because there were no responses. I mean, there were times when she spoke about violence, police violence, for example, against African Americans, when there were many responses. But when she brought this issue up, I mean, sometimes somebody might say LOL or it sucks, depression sucks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was really just silence. And I have heard people say, who were part of her world, you know, she just had a bad day. I mean, we all have a bad day. But I think there's too much on her social media to call it a bad day. And there's too many facts that have come out, and too many documentary facts that have come out indicating that she suffered from depression.
It's almost like a call for help. Nobody really seems to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I think she was bravely calling for help. I think she was bravely calling for help from the very end, because when she was in the jail, she said she was depressed. And they didn't listen either, and they were certainly the people who were supposed to be listening. That's their job.
Debbie, tell us a little more about not only her depression, but the circumstances that were sort of seemed to be surrounding that and leading to it. I mean, was it something that you found out developed during college when she was at Prairie View A&M?
You know, I'm a little wary of just talking about depression mm-hmm. as though it's just something that happens, you know, coming out of the inside of you. I mean, there's so much about her life. There's so many stressors on her life that are very race-based. And, for example, she graduated college in 2009 at the height of the recession, when if you look at statistics about unemployment and race, you see that young black BAs, people who have just gotten college degrees, like her, have a very hard time finding jobs, even harder than white students or white graduates who were themselves having a hard time. But it's much worse for black people, and it's much worse for black women with BAs than it is for black men. I mean, the black women are on the bottom of this whole bad situation. So she had a very hard time getting a job that really fit her degree. And you know, again, she'd been a very good student. She was constantly being stopped for these sort of driving while black traffic stops in both Texas and when she went back to Illinois, where she was from. She was arrested in Houston for marijuana under circumstances that I don't think would have happened to a young white driver, because the statistics all show in the Houston area that black people are three times more likely to be arrested for marijuana. So she had so many stressors in her life that, you know, I'm sure it's very hard to tease out, like, what causes depression, right? Why does it go up? Why does it get better? Why does it get worse? I mean, with Sandra, it's almost impossible to separate all of the bad things that are happening to her simply because she's a young black woman from how she feels in some organic way.
Right.
I don't think you can separate those things at all. And I think that a lot of what's happening to her is happening to millions of young black people.
And she's becoming increasingly conscious of the systemic sort of injustices. I mean, in your article, you explained that Texas police disproportionately issue tickets to minority drivers, many of whom are poor, and that the tickets usually include all sorts of extra fees. What sorts of fees are we talking about?
It's everything from, you know, fees to keep court records to fees to treat people that have, I don't know, you know, some disease, I forgot what, like muscular dystrophy or something similar. There have even been fees to increase security on the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, you know, if you get a traffic ticket in Texas, you have the ticket can double or triple because of all of these other charges that really act like taxes against individuals. And they fund, Texas does not have an income tax. So traffic tickets in Texas fund a lot of municipal services and a lot of state services. So she's getting all of these tickets. And like you say, I don't think that she was aware in the beginning of what all this meant, you know, politically. But there comes a time when she becomes very interested in all of the kinds of issues that Black Lives Matter is interested in. And I think she started to see a lot of things that were going on in her life as political and racist issues. And you know, that's just got to be very painful and very angering.
You mentioned that she saw the film Selma. That helped radicalize her to some extent, didn't it?
She did. That's what she told people. Mm-hmm. She saw it right when it came to Chicago. And it is a very dramatic film. Yeah.
Was she having these conversations via her videos with a growing community of people who felt increasingly sort of politicized by what's happening, Black Lives Matter and whatnot?
You know, I think so. I mean, I didn't watch the growth of her Facebook page. Of course, the day that she died, that was the day that nobody else joined. I mean, that page sits there now. You can look at it. It sits there like a monument. It's still. But I didn't see that page grow, but I did see that it had 1,800 people on it, and I suspect that it grew fast as she made this turn into an interest in politics and Black Lives Matter issues.
One thing I hadn't realized until I read your article was that when she was going down for this job, and after her death, when we were, you know, introduced to Sandra Bland, you know, posthumously, we were told, oh, she was starting over a new life. But this job, which she was going for, was only for 4 weeks. Am I right?
Yeah, it's a story that, I mean, I think it's so easy to relate to what really happened. She was getting increasingly frustrated in Illinois with, she actually had a job. She'd finally gotten a job in Illinois. Didn't pay very much, but it was a steady job. It had benefits, which was unlike these temporary jobs that she was always working so hard at. She got this full-time job, but it turned out that it was with a company that almost has the monopoly in the United States for prison kitchenware and cooking utensils. So, you know, it has like... she made a video for this company where she's holding up this really soft rubber spoon, and she's bending it back and forth, and she's had like a manicure, you know, because, I mean, this is a video for the company, so she's really trying to do this right. So she bends the spoon back and forth, and she says, you know, this is a really good spoon because it cannot be sharpened into a weapon. And as she became more and more involved with Black Lives Matter thinking, she came to understand that she, as she told one of her friends, that she was engaged with the prison industrial complex, that she was working with the prison industrial complex, and it hurt her that she was engaged with an industry that was incarcerating young Black men. So it really bothered her. She talked to somebody about this at length. And you know, I try to imagine what it took for her. She quit the job. This was the first job she'd been able to get in years. She walked away from the job. What that would have taken to do that. So now she's jobless. She has no insurance. She has epilepsy. She's depressed. And she has no health insurance. And she is not happy with her personal life. She's in a situation with a boyfriend that she's not happy with at all. And she doesn't have a job. And she's pretty frustrated, if not desperate. And she applied for some jobs on the website of her alma mater. And she loved her alma mater. She had a wonderful time down there in Texas. And she loved the alma mater. And so she applied for some jobs. And one of the jobs actually fit her major, which was animal science. She was, oddly enough and interestingly enough, majored in agricultural subjects. So she applied for a job as an extension agent. And that was it fit her training. It was for a person with a BA. But then there were two other jobs she applied for, and they were basically just minor clerical jobs, and they were temporary. So she got a call saying that they wanted to interview her the next day. And she just drove all night, 1,000 miles from Illinois, and went to these interviews, and she got one of the clerical jobs that didn't pay that well and only was going to last for a month. She was still really happy. I think she just felt like, you know, I just had to get away, and I've just got to go someplace that makes me happy, and I don't know how I'm going to make this work, but I'll make it work. And so she was just desperately happy. But the kicker was that the hiring letter said, if you have a criminal record, a current criminal record, we have the right to rescind this hire. That's the last thing that she got before she was brutalized by this trooper and put in jail with a felony charge.
So she's going to a job which is very uncertain about whether she can actually be able to keep it. In a best-case scenario, she's going to have it for 4 weeks. It doesn't pay very well. Does she also have a lot of debt that she's accumulated from all these tickets and whatnot, legal fees?
From the records that I've seen, I believe that she still had several hundred dollars in debt down in Texas. And I've asked myself what she was going to do. She's working in a rural environment. They asked her if she had a car and a license. Well, actually, if she doesn't pay several hundred dollars in these tickets, then she's not going to have a license. So there's another problem she's going to have to overcome.
All around the world.
World nigga law.
But right now, I want to get right into the biggest news of the last couple of days. You know, we've been talking a lot about Andrew Locu, a 45-year-old father of five, a Black man who was shot and killed by the police on July 5th of last year in his apartment just off of Eglinton Avenue West. There was a special investigations unit investigation into Andrew Locu's death. And that happens every time someone is believed to have been hurt or killed or sexually assaulted by our police. There's an investigation. But since the SIU has existed in 1990 to investigate the police, to be an independent watchdog, none of the reports about how police hurt or potentially kill people have ever been released until just this past Friday. Premier Kathleen Wynne said that she was going to release and publicize the report, the SIU report regarding Andrew Locu. We didn't know when it was going to happen, and then this Friday afternoon, it did happen, except not in the way that anyone expected. The public received 9 out of the 34 pages of this SIU report, and they were heavily, heavily redacted. Even the pages that were received had some things omitted from them. But a 34-page report on a man who was killed by the police, and only 9 pages of the report were released. This is after Premier Wynne promised accountability, transparency. What this means is that based on what was given, it is basically impossible to determine how the SIU came to their decision not to charge anyone in the killing of Andrew Locu. We can't know how they came to that decision because the province refuses to show us after promising transparency. But we did learn a couple of really, really important things from what was released. The biggest thing that we learned was that the police actually tried, according to the SIU, not according to me, according to the report, to interfere with the investigation by downloading and accessing video from Andrew Locu's apartment before the SIU could do. And that is a violation of the police's duties. Again, that's the director saying that. That's not me. So there was video evidence of this incident, or at least of part of it, and the police tried to get it before the SIU could come in and investigate, which is against all of their responsibilities and their code. And I want to read you what was said by the SIU director about that. He said, quote, "Based on the unit's forensic examination of the recording, it would not appear that there was anything nefarious about the so-called gap in question, and that the camera had simply not recorded the shooting. That explanation, however, becomes more difficult to accept when police unduly insert themselves in the post-incident investigation as they appear to have done in this case." That's the director of the SIU, Tony Loparco, saying that police tried to get this video and that afterwards people said it appears that there may be gaps in this video. And the SIU saying, we don't determine that there were, but it's really hard to know because the police interfered and they should never have done so. I'm joined right now in studio by Sandy Hudson, who is a co-founder and organizer with Black Lives Matter Toronto. And Black Lives Matter Toronto, of course, as you know, is probably the reason why we got 9 pages of 34 at all. Because before this was going on, the province wasn't going to release anything and historically never has. But Sandy Hudson, I imagine that this is not what you were expecting when the province promised transparency.
No, it most definitely is not. 9 out of 34 pages, as you have just said, can in no way be considered any measure of transparency or accountability. I was extremely frustrated to see that.
And what of the idea by Tony Loparco here that police committed a violation by trying to access video from Andrew Locu's house, but Tony Loparco doesn't name the police officer who did that, even though it's very clear that the SIU knows who did it. And there are no charges against the police officer who tried to access and download that video before the SIU. What is your feeling of that?
Well, I don't understand how they made that decision. How are you going to acknowledge that there has been some serious wrongdoing done and then say, no, we're not going to charge, we're not going to investigate a little bit more in a court of law this wrongdoing? And what's even more frustrating about that piece of information that was released in the report is that it makes reference to this being a pattern of behavior.
Correct.
So this is a pattern of behavior that's been going on with police officers, tampering with evidence that's going to the SIU. I mean, we'd heard about that a little bit with the Jermaine Carby case, a man who was killed by police in Brampton, that there was tampering with a knife that was supposedly at the scene and then was gone for hours and then arrived on the scene. This is clearly an issue. Why are we only hearing about it now in the public? Why are they deciding not to charge these police officers to learn a little bit more about what's happening? And what are they doing to stop this pattern from happening?
And Sandy, I mean, what about Premier Kathleen Wynne and the Minister of the Attorney General, Madeleine Mayer, and all of this? Because they met with you on the lawn of Queen's Park and they told you that they would be transparent. And then days later, they said that this report was coming out. What do you think of the fact that on a Friday afternoon, when most of us in the news media are going home for the weekend, that was the time that 9 out of 34 pages of this report were decided to be released, and there's no statement from any of the politicians? How does that strike you?
I think it is manipulative, in a word. I think they knew ahead of time that they were going to do that on Friday. They could have given the media, the family, anybody a heads up. For us, this was very emotional. I was really shocked to see that that was something that was coming out that day when I read it. Andrew's close friends were also very upset and shocked. And the media, of course, was not ready for it. I think what this amounts to is a situation where the decision makers know that they need to appear transparent because of the public ire on this case. And so they're doing as little as possible to make it seem like they're moving. But they've got to know that that's not okay with us and that we will be pushing back on that.
The social media fury and broader fury is today reserved for a Cape Townian, somebody who lives in Nuitton, called Matthew Tiernison. He posted this. The news websites and the newspapers are able to print it out in full. I can't get away with that in radio. I have to do a little bit of bleeping. But in response to the announcement by the Sports and Recreation Minister, Fikile Mbalula, that 3 sporting codes were going to be banned from hosting international tournaments, Matthew Tiernison posted on Facebook, "So no more sporting events for South Africa. I've never been more proud than to say our government are a bunch of K's. Yes, I said it. So go and F yourselves, you black effing C's," using the Anglo-Saxon word for the female genitalia. Matthew Tiernison is on the line to us now. Hello, Matthew.
Hello, John. How are you doing?
What was going through your mind when you said that? I mean, you must at some level have known what was going to result. Why did you post that using the language that you used?
To be honest with you, John, I was feeling very angry at the statement that the sports minister made, and I know that's no excuse whatsoever. Sports are a massive passion of mine, and I've also been looking for a job for the last year, and with the current politics in the country, I haven't been able to find employment. But besides that, the main thing that made me say those words, which I regret so dearly, is the fact that we aren't allowed to hold international sporting events, and it's a very big passion of mine. I was in an extremely, extremely bad mood and bad place, and I immediately reacted by deleting the post. Unfortunately, it got to more people, well, everyone, and I didn't intend to say those words.
But I'll
regret for the rest of my life.
You did intend to say those words, Matthew. You wrote them. You sat down at a computer and you typed out those words on a keyboard. You did mean them.
I did type the words, but I immediately regretted the language that I used because it is extremely hurtful and inappropriate.
Other people are angry, but there's another option for releasing your angers, to say, "Minister Mbalula, I disagree completely with the announcement that you have made, and these are the reasons why I think you are wrong." To resort to this level of language, despite your anger, says, does it say something about the kind of person that you are?
Well, to be honest with you, John, this really isn't the type of person I am. If you could speak to any of my friends or my family or any of my previous colleagues, they'll tell you that I'm not racist at all. I did have a good go at the government. I didn't refer to the whole country in that sense. Doesn't make it any better. But I did refer primarily to government, and I understand that I did use very hurtful language, and it is, I mean, I will regret it for the rest of my life. There's nothing I can do. It's done now, and all I'm trying to do now is tell my side of the story and apologize to everybody that it affected and impacted.
Almost everybody who is bussed for using the kind of language that you used says, but I'm not racist. My contention is that people who are not racist never, ever, no matter the circumstances, no matter the provocation, no matter the bad state they are in, they never resort to language like you resorted to.
Yes, I agree with you. And like I said, that's why I truly regret it. I shouldn't have used those words. And like you say, I should have addressed the sports minister directly in plain language. And that would have been a much better way to vent. There's no doubt about that. And I truly feel guilty. And I am not a racist. To be honest with you, I'm an individualist. I like you. If I like you, it's got nothing to do with the color of your skin or what language you speak or anything. I've plenty of friends that are of color that work with or work around me, and also from my schooling years, I played rugby with them.
But you're falling, Matthew, into two traps.
Okay.
If you use racist language, as far as I'm concerned, that means there is an element of racism in you. It's maybe not an element that you are prepared to admit at the moment, and maybe it's something that you should look a little more deeply into the mirror. I simply don't believe that a non-racist would say, under any circumstances, that you're a bunch of kaffirs. And then you're also falling into the, some of my best friends are black, therefore I'm not a racist trap, which again is...
I never said some of my best friends. I said you can ask anyone about my character and nobody will tell you that I'm a racist.
Will they still say that? Will those people still say Matthew's not a racist, or will some of them say, you know, maybe Matthew is a racist?
Some of them may say Matthew's a racist, but that's entirely my fault.
So again, you as an explanation or as a reason for the bad state that you were in when you posted these words, you said you haven't been able to get a job for a year, and that's because of the politics in this country, implying that affirmative action is keeping you out of a job, when the reality is that white graduates, and you are a double master's graduate, so you are academically very well qualified, but the reality is that the vast number of white graduates get jobs, and a very small number, relatively speaking, of black graduates get jobs. So the economic reality in this country, no matter what you think of the politics, is that white graduates are still significantly more likely to get a job than black graduates. So again, that as a reason for your bad state falls a little short when critically examined.
Yes, I completely agree with you, John. Like I say, I've got no excuse, to be honest with you. I have no excuse at all. I just wanted to apologize, and I'm truly sorry for using hurtful language, and I really didn't mean to offend anybody. And like I say, I immediately deleted it off my Facebook profile, but somebody had screen captured the image and put it on Twitter. So that's where it became so viral. I'm in complete disbelief. I thought I'd got it down in time, and I really didn't mean to say it, otherwise I wouldn't have deleted it.
No, but you did mean to say it, otherwise you wouldn't have written it.
Well, I wrote it out of anger, but then when I calmed down, then I realized that it was the wrong thing to do. I mean, do we not all do different things when we're feeling different emotions?
What has been the response? I know that the media have been trying to get a hold of you. I know that you've not been answering your phone, but you will have spoken to friends and acquaintances and family. And what has been their response?
They've just been supportive for the family, and they've just wished us all the best to try and get through it as soon as we possibly can and get the apology out there and start healing the people in South Africa. There's been my phone's off because I can't turn it on. I don't think I can receive any more messages or phone calls. So I have been using other means of communication. But, yeah, so far it's just been support to try and get through the hard time.
Okay, so what do you do now? You are being reported to the Human Rights Commission. They will investigate this. Yes. This is not something that you can deny. It doesn't sound like something that you want to deny. You acknowledge. But do you think that the apology that you've offered me now is enough? What do you need to do more? What are the impacts that you think this is likely to have on your life? Are you going to approach the HRC and say, can we have an immediate hearing and give me whatever sanction you think is appropriate? How are you going to handle it from now on?
I will get hold of the Human Rights Commission. And I'll deal with them directly and see how they want to pursue the matter. So I'm going to do this, no running away from it. I'm going to do everything I have to do and everything I want to do in order to just get rid of that part of my life and the biggest mistake I've made in my life.
Have you had a conversation with a black friend about this? Because I'm looking at our Twitter timeline at the moment, and there are a lot of black people who don't think that I should have given you the airtime, who are being very critical of Cape Talk for having given you the airtime. And certainly there's not a great deal of sympathy being expressed for your apology, not a great deal of, that's all right then, he's apologized. In fact,
no, sure, and I mean, it's going to be like that with anything. Whenever there's a racist slur or anything political or racist, when it's on social media, you can't just apologize. I mean, people aren't going to, the people obviously think that I'm being insincere. I can tell you honestly that I'm not. But at the end of the day, everyone's entitled to their opinion. There's no way of me changing their minds. All I can do, like I say, is I'm going to approach every avenue I can possibly in order for this to go away and in order for me to move on as an individual and also help the rest of the country get past the nasty things that I said.
And the C word, Matthew, a lot of some tweets and some SMSs don't obviously come from a man or a woman, but those where a name is attached, they're obviously from women who are almost as offended by your use of the C word, indicating that they feel that you're as much of a sexist as you are a racist.
No, well, to me, I had no intention of using that word to offend women. I thought the whole problem was the use of the K word, which I know is absolutely terrible, and I never use it, and like I said, it was completely out of character. There's nothing I can say or do to convince people if they aren't going to accept my apology.
Oh, I wish I was in the land of...
With a song people sing without quite knowing what it means. It is the Kentucky State Song, which will be part of the annual ritual of tomorrow's Kentucky Derby.
Please rise and sing along as the University of Louisville marching band plays My Old Kentucky Home.
People wearing crazy hats, holding mint juleps, sing the words, "The sun shines bright on my old Kentucky home." Seems to be about people who miss their happy home.
Weep no more, my lady. Oh, weep no more.
And that line about weeping, sung there by John Prine, makes people weep. Yet a man who grew up in Kentucky suspects that most people miss the point.
I love my state, but at the same time, you know, the memories, the history this conjures up, I think people sing it and it's totally disconnected from the history, from the truth.
Frank X. Walker is a former poet laureate of Kentucky. He read through some of the lyrics with us.
The young folks roll on the little cabin floor, all merry, all happy and bright. By and by hard times come knocking at the door. Then my old Kentucky home, good night.
What's happening there?
Well, it sounds like a happy family environment and a humble cabin experience.
Sounds like, but there's something more. The great composer Stephen Foster wrote this song in the 1850s, before the Civil War, and the characters, having to leave Kentucky, were slaves.
By and by hard times come a-knocking at the door, then my old Kentucky home, good night.
And what's happening, I guess, is the owner ran out of money, and the people who were enslaved were being sold downriver. Wasn't that the phrase? You'd be sold
further south,
where life was considered even more brutal.
And harder, and not just more brutal, but with a shorter life expectancy.
People today rarely sing the song's final verse. That verse shows the slaves are going to sugarcane plantations, where they might be worked to death in the sun.
Few more days and the trouble all will end in the field where the sugarcanes grow.
That's the entertainer and activist Paul Robeson, who did sing the final verse generations ago. Another part of the song has vanished today. Stephen Foster's original lyric called the slaves darkies. Today, that offensive word is not sung, but that leaves no explicit reference to black people. The truth is, My Old Kentucky Home was originally sold as an anti-slavery song. Not only that, poet Frank X. Walker thinks Stephen Foster wrote a lousy anti-slavery song.
You know, he wasn't from Kentucky, so he imagined or he witnessed something that suggested that it was a great place to be a slave. And my issue is that there were no good places to be enslaved.
So when I go through this story, I feel a tragedy. It's not nostalgic. It actually hurts.
Now you're in my territory. And for me, when I hear the song, if I would shed a tear, it would be for the pain of those who suffered in that way.
Walker would like people to know that story, even if they always thought they were hearing a simple, romantic song of home.
Oh, the sun shines bright on my own.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Theme music written by B.J. Lederman, arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
Oh, the sun shines bright.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade. In for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 7th, 2016. So I have been told. Compensatory call-in. Feel free to dial in if you have observations, things you would like to share. Certainly we will get to workplace racism down the road. Number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. The blog address, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported, kept us rolling for 7+ years. Quick notes before we get to folks who have commentary, things that they would like to share. Number one, we'll be back on Monday. Josh Gibson should be on the program. He's been with us many times before, Trapped in Rainbows, The Suppressed Rebellion, The Monsters We Create About Racism in the Classroom. He should be here on Monday talking about his new book, How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain. Same time on Monday. Dr. Tommy Curry should be with us this coming Wednesday. Just check Black Talk Radio page or the Facebook page for updates as we roll. Quick things that I will get in. There was a lot that went on this week. They had the conviction in the quote-unquote grim sleeper trial down in Southern California, Los Angeles. Lonnie Franklin, black male, was convicted where he had been killing black females for decades in L.A., and they explicitly state, number one, they did not connect all of these cases, these black females that were being killed, and they really didn't care because they were black. Who cares? I wrote about this last year. They have a documentary on this case, but they did get a conviction this week. That was something I was trying to make space for as well to include, but I thought that was significant that went down this week. Also, certainly with the passing of Dr. Afeni Shakur, I mentioned John Potash when we talked about that earlier this week. I emailed him to see if he had any thoughts around what happened. Hopefully we can do a broadcast to talk more about her life and her sudden death in the coming days. But I emailed John Potash. This is what he said when he wrote me back. He said, here's a few issues I have with what's being said that happened when Afeni died. He does know Dr. Afeni Shakur, so I would give him a bit more leeway in referring to her on a first-name basis because I believe he did speak with her and do some documentation before he wrote his first book about her son. So moving forward. First, why, when someone calls 911 about Afeni feeling very ill, would police immediately come to the scene versus just EMT workers? If someone knows better, tell me. And this is a quote from the reports that came out about her death. Marin County Sheriff's deputies and firefighters responded to Shakur's houseboat in Sausalito, California, Monday night after she fell ill and suffered a suspected heart attack. Back to Mr. Potash. Secondly, why would you say there was no foul play and nothing suspicious unless there was originally something that might suggest that? Back to the articles, the reports. At this point, there is nothing to indicate to us that there was any foul play, nothing suspicious about this other than this being sadly a natural event, Marin County Sheriff's Lieutenant Doug Pittman said. Back to Mr. Potash, trust me, I don't want this to be another murder. I live fearful enough as it is, delving into this, into the short lifespan of bringing justice to the Tupac Shakur case, as well as the MK Ultra drug writers. That was his response in the email. Again, hopefully we'll be able to do some programs to follow up on this as we roll. The last thing that I will get in, again, reading is more important than watching television. I would encourage anybody, if you are looking for more information about Dr. Afeni Shakur, John Potash, Suspected Racist, his first book, The FBI's War on Tupac Shakur, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, gives a lot of background information about Dr. Afeni Shakur, her work with the Black Panther Party, Republic of New Africa, and all of the folks who produced Tupac Shakur and what happened with his life and death as well. Last thing that I will get in, again, reading more important than watching television, The American Slave Coast. I think that is the runaway best book that I have read this year. I'm glad we got the authors on the program. Also, Suspected Racists, but extremely good book. Lots of great information. The rape of black females, central to the theme of that book. But they mention the state song of Kentucky in that book. I was so glad I remember because I had highlighted that portion. I don't know if I brought it up with them when they were on the program, but just the portion where they talk about the Kentucky song that was sung at the Kentucky Derby today. Sentimental popular songs referred to the interstate slave trade in response to Harriet Beecher Stowe's book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. Stephen Foster's My Old Kentucky Home, premiered in 1853 by Christie's Minstrels, was at first titled Poor Uncle Tom, Good Night, before Foster rewrote it. It's now the state song of Kentucky, but they don't sing the third verse anymore. The third verse is, the head must bow and the back will have to bend wherever the darky may go. A few more days and the trouble will all end in the field where the sugarcane grows. A few more days for to tote the weary load, no matter, 'twill never be light. A few more days till we totter on the road, then my old Kentucky home, good night. That's a song, back to the sublets, that's a song about a black man from Kentucky being worked to death in a sugar prison camp in Louisiana. Benjamin Hanby's tear-jerking My Darling Nellie Gray, 1856, which Hanby based on a story told to him as a child by a black man named Joseph Selby, sang of an enslaved couple broken apart by a sale of the woman to Georgia. And then the verses, "Oh, my poor Nellie Gray, they have taken you away, and I'll never see my darling anymore. I'm sitting by the river, and I'm weeping all the day, for you're gone from the old Kentucky shore." This genre of songs continued after the Civil War. James Bland's Carry Me Back to Old Virginny, when they were bolderized and bizarrely repurposed into a nostalgia for the Old South. We've talked about Carry Me Back to Old Virginny before. That was the Virginia state song for many, many years, and it took them 2 decades to find a new state song after Doug Wilder and others voiced that this is just having a state song in worship of white supremacy. They could not even figure out how to have a state song that was not associated with white supremacy for 20 years. That is white supremacy, the world that we live in, what it means to be white. I'm sure they had this song sung at the Kentucky Derby today, and nobody even gave it a second thought. Moving forward, if folks have anything they would like to share, feel free to dial in. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Again, no metaphors for the compensatory call-in. We could be clear, explicit, direct with what it is that we're trying to say. Frequently, the metaphors, analogies, comparisons, a lot of times they're simply inaccurate. The things that people are comparing when they're trying to articulate or give their views on racism, counter-racism, and frequently, I have concluded a lot of times white people do this deliberately to be deceptive. They know they're making false comparisons, false equivalencies. I think sometimes non-white people, we do this just because in our victimization, we're still trying to get clarity, trying to get better understanding of racism, white supremacy, so the things that we're comparing don't really help generate a clearer understanding of racism. So if we can just be direct, no metaphors, that would be great, super appreciated, and I will make an effort to alert, let folks know when you have used a metaphor. That being said, the folks that dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I was in Boston, Mass, and was watching CNN, and it's a commercial that kept going over and over again about one of the TV personalities on CNN, black male, Afro, and in the commercial, it kept airing, I guess it was trying to make some kind of display about different types of people. One of these different types of people was some individuals in Ku Klux Klan outfits in the commercial. I was just wondering, did anybody see that commercial? I believe the person, his name, part of his name, I think it had Kamau in it.
It's W. Does Kamau.
That name
Bell.
Sound familiar?
It's W. Kamau.
Yeah,
Bell.
Yes.
He's a comedian.
Yeah. I mean, they kept running this commercial over and over and over again. And, well, actually, it was different. It was different, slightly different, a couple of times. But in the commercial, I don't know if it was trying to be funny or what. But if it was a tip to kind of like make some distinction between different types of people, they really blew it. on that one. I suspect it was a white person practicing racism behind it also, with these Ku Klux Klan members in this commercial. I mean, not saying that it, all the rest of the white people also were in the commercial are suspected racists also, but it's kind of like weird, you know, to see that, you know. I'm just wondering if anybody else saw that. That's all I have right now.
It was a segment that they did on CNN. W. Kamau Bell is, that should be a cowbell. In fact, that was the debut of the cowbell, was W. Kamau Bell's visit to this program back in the spring of 2010. Actually, it wasn't spring yet, technically. It was the 1st of March, but 2010. But he is married to a white woman. He does comedy. He does stand-up routines where he talks a lot about racism. He had a television program on the FX channel that ran about two seasons where he focused a lot on racism. That's kind of his thing, making jokes and, you know, talking about racism. He has comedy CDs out as well, but yeah, he allegedly did this special on CNN where he met with these Klan members and talked. I think you can see this online if people are interested in seeing the segment.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was going to say, I think the show is called United Shades of America. It's some show that they gave him where he's traveling around the country dealing with issues of race, I believe. And I saw a part of that first episode, and they had him interviewing some grand wizard of the modern-day Klan, like in the dark, in the middle of nowhere, in some field. And it looked like a very uncomfortable situation for him, and he kind of alluded to it. I didn't see the whole show. He kind of annoys me, so it's hard for me to really, like, take him seriously. But he alludes to it in the section that I saw about himself being uncomfortable in that environment, dark, you know, and it was, like, pitch black. You could barely see in front of your face, minus the light from the camera, and he's interviewing this Klansman about, you know, the modern-day Klan, and he's trying to use his rhetorical ethic to try and make it seem like the Klan is no more racist today, or less racist today than it was back in the days. It's really interesting, but yeah, that's the name of the show. So I know what he's talking about with the commercial, because they did show it quite a bit. But I wanted to also get into some of the clips. First I wanted to let you know that, speaking of Henrietta Lack, Thomas brought her up yesterday when we were reading the book. Oprah Winfrey is tapped to play Henrietta Lacks. It's coming up, and I think in the next few months on HBO, they're doing like a biopic or the movie, and Oprah's set to play Henrietta Lacks. So the only reason I would watch it is just to compare what we read in the book versus what white people portray and have Oprah portray. But I just wanted to let you know about that. Also, the clip on Andrew Locu, I found that it was, as far as like the way that the government talked about transparency and then put out this 9 pages of the 34-page report, but that was heavily redacted, so you basically got nothing from it, really speaks to, there was a caller that called in regularly from Canada who talks about the sophistication of the racism in Canada. I think that was a brilliant display of that through the skillful use of rhetorical ethic. And it's something that if you really pay attention to, will give you a great understanding that up there, it's probably way more sophisticated, intricately sophisticated. Not that they don't do things very similar down here. They do that all the time. But I just think that for that to be on public display and for them to call it out so skillfully in the whoever actually conveyed the news story, I thought that was really brilliant. The other one about, I think he was a South African soccer player who basically made racist statement on, I think, his Twitter page, and someone took a picture, on his Facebook page, and someone took a picture of it, and it went viral. I loved the way the interviewer called him out on the nonsense he was speaking about having non-white friends and all the other cliche things he was saying to try and make himself not look like exactly what he is, which is a racist white supremacist. I found that very interesting. Also, I saw an article in the Independent UK where it said that U.S. companies have been given permission to bring people back from the dead, and they're looking into different ways of doing that. So this is an expansion of the whole zombie thing, and it's just interesting to actually see that they're And then I saw that NPR put out an article on, and this took me to Breaking Bad, about a Massachusetts chemist that was high on drugs for 8 years at work, from drugs that she stole from the job and drugs that she manufactured on the job. And she used crystal meth. She manufactured crack cocaine, they said. She also sniffed cocaine. She did just about every chemical, LSD. They brought up all the drugs that she was doing for 8 years on the job. And it was an NPR article that I read yesterday. And I think there was one more thing. Oh, yes, the clip on Sandra Bland I found to be really, really powerful. And the discussion on depression I thought was very telling, because that's something that we've talked about fairly regularly here. And it's interesting because she talked about the lack of Black people's inability to deal with depression in the Black community. And it made me think of African institutions. Traditional institutions did have remedies for mental illness. Usually you would go to a high priest and have readings done and things of that nature. And there was also sessions where you would sit and be able to have these sorts of discussions. There's a great book by Credo Mutwa. It's called Zulu Shaman, and he kind of discusses their methods of dealing, the reasons why they did not have jails in South Africa, and their spiritual methods for dealing with different crimes up to and including murder, and how they were able to successfully reform and using traditional medicine, reform people who were murderers and reintegrate them back into society. So that was just something I wanted to talk about, because I thought that the clip on that they had on her was very fascinating and profound, and just gave me a deep respect for her even more, because I never got to see her Facebook page. I'm not a person who uses Facebook at all, or any social media for that matter. So just to hear such an endearing story about making her a holistic person, I thought was great. And thank you so much for taking my call, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. I saw that episode of the W. Kamau Bell interviewing the Ku Klux Klan. I thought it was hilarious, in my opinion. And, you know, of course, I watched it with a counter-racist eye, but what caught my eye was, I think I sent you an email, Gus, there's a few cities after I looked it up, but he focused on one of them with the big billboard up that says anti-racist is anti-white. And I just thought that was just, they should be up everywhere. So I thought it was a good show. However, it was a lot of, I don't think racism, white supremacy is a joking matter. And to make a joke out of it, I think, you know, it just really undermines it, and it serves the purpose of white people. I didn't take notes because I was shopping while the show was on, but like Bob just said, that clip with Sandra Bland was extremely good. Because, man, I didn't know she suffered from such mental illness. And I could just imagine, you know, working so hard to get a job, you know, and you get it, and then this cop pulls you over, and now you have these felony charges, and now you're like, man, I'm not going to get the job. I still don't think she killed herself, but I think that she definitely was suffering from some depression. And it was something that probably could have been fixed very easily if she was white and getting the proper treatment that whites get. Other than that, I wanted to say you touched on it the last show. Not the last show. It was the show where the Black Lives Matter lady didn't show up this week. And the lady asked, and you was talking about the racism as far as in the housing market and things. And I was going to add in, but we didn't have time. If you saw Detroit this week, they had their teachers go on strike. Well, not strike, but they called out sick one day. I believe it was like 90-something percent of the teachers all called out sick because they won't be getting paid for the summer pay or for the summer months, which is messed up because, you know, they take a decreased salary all year so they can get their paychecks, you know, during the summer. And after taking your decreased salary all year, and then they tell you they're not going to pay you for the summer, it's like they're pretty much, they got you to work for, you know, less than what you're supposed to get. But if you look at the location of Detroit and also Flint, right there is the Detroit River. And a huge part of NAFTA, is to create that Detroit River. It's a Detroit River acts as a canal. I believe it's between Lake Huron and Lake Erie. It's a natural canal that you can get goods from one lake to the other. And that area years ago was slated to be completely cleared out so that they could start their building the infrastructure and moving in the people they want to move into those areas to work and all those lucrative jobs and things that's about to start up there. So, you know, they're being forced out because if you can't send your kids to school and you're not doing homeschooling, that's illegal. And they could take your kids from you. They could arrest you. So for them to close the schools, which they probably will do next year in Detroit, those people will all have to leave and find a municipality with public schools and, of course, in Flint, find a municipality with clean water. And then expect for that to see a huge boom in development up in those cities, which were once black cities, but will become white again and be filled with jobs. And I'm in home, I think.
Other folks that we haven't heard from, did y'all have commentary?
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Excuse me. Hey, good evening. This is the Bronx Caller. So let me, I'd like to take a couple notes. The Tennessee massacre, I thought it was interesting in, I guess, like just generally, in, excuse me, generally interesting the way whites use language, you know, in the system of white supremacy. So I just seemed like it was just interesting the way they use language to conceal that Tennessee massacre. Even like in the clip, like the way they were describing it, it seemed like if I don't know, I guess like black people, you know, we haven't had our, you know, Holocaust or whatever recognized as such, so it can just be kind of dismissed as like, oh, you know, these women were raped and, you know, all these people were killed and all this stuff, and then like it can just kind of be dismissed as like some little, you know, blurb. But yeah, just the whole language thing. And then like the woman who was talking about Sandra Bland also, it seemed to me like she was being showcased, like Sandra Bland was being showcased by this racist female. I checked it out and it was a racist female, you know, white female doing the narration of Sandra Bland stuff, which I was glad to hear, you know, as a black person. I mean, I was glad, you know, hear something about her life and stuff like that. But I mean, it, the way that she described the incident and everything, and just, it reminded me of At the Dark End of the Street, which was just the account of how, like, you know, black women being raped by white men was central to, what we call the civil rights era and all of the, upheaval that, you know, it all came from black communities just crossing the line at these white men just coming in and doing anything they wanted to black females. And I just was focusing on how they were just, I guess that's what it was about. They were talking about her mind state and everything, but it just seemed kind of weird. Like Trayvon Martin, you know, was on, like how he was on trial after having been murdered, like, okay, why are you just talking about her being depressed? Like, while she's like butt naked in jail, like, anyway. Yeah. And they use the term like radicalization and stuff like that. And I kind of sense some fake pain in the woman's voice who's talking about Sandra Bland. I don't know. It's kind of like, oh, I'm a white woman talking about a black woman's pain. And I heard this kind of fake kind of, you know, tension in her voice, but anyway, hey, did you guys hear? I listen to the archives when I can't listen live, but I'm sure you guys saw that. But I just didn't hear anybody discussing it or anything. But you know, I know you're about the racist jokes and everything, and the Hillary Clinton and you know, this maximum aggressive racist mayor we have in New York, with that little CPT time joke. I'm sure you heard about that, Gus.
Oh, that's old. We talked about that like a long time ago. Yeah, Mayor de Blasio.
Yeah, like that was like I was waiting. I was like, because I after I heard it, I guess maybe I was late to it, so I didn't catch the show where you guys talked about it.
Yeah, I think it was Professor Vernon Burton. He was a white suspected racist in South Carolina. He failed to show up, and so we had extra time. Retired firefighter blooded up, but yeah, we discussed it in detail some weeks ago.
Okay, I'll go back and check that out. All right, that's all I was going to talk about. Thanks for listening. I'll come in more. Sorry, I was going to say I'll dig some up out of the archives for some workplace racism.
All right, on. I was just going to say really quick, the language on that piece I thought was really important when they were talking about what happened in Tennessee, because I had never even heard about that incident, and I'm sure there's tons of incidents of that sort of thing that have taken place. The only thing I was going to say, terrorism, that is not white privilege and all the other nonsense terms that folks use. That is what we're talking about is terrorism. That was all I was going to say. Other folks who had comments, feel free, that we haven't heard.
Matt Beard.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to say hi to everybody tonight. Thank you, Gus, for the show, of course. This is V from Central New York. I'd like to first start off and say what Gus always says is very true. It is more important to read than to watch TV. I've made the conscious decision about 3 years ago to stop having television in my apartment. I'm telling you, it is the greatest thing I ever did. Couple of things. First and foremost, I'd like to suggest a book to anybody who really has, you know, just a weekend that they have time to kill. The Colonizer and the Colonized, an absolutely amazing book. Very short read, maybe less than 200 pages, but it's like water. It just goes through you. It's very well written, very easily written, but gives you a lot to think about. I really only have one comment on the clips that you played, the Sandra Bland clip. To say that it touches me to hear what she was going through is an understatement. I was in the library a couple of weeks ago, and this probably 9-year-old black girl comes in. She's looking at the magazines and what have you. And I smile at her and I wave, and she stops and she looks at me strange. And then she smiles at me and waves, and then walks away, comes back, looks back at me, and then walks away again. And I saw her again about a week later, and I said hi to her. And she asked me my name. I told her. I asked her. She told me. And she asked if I came there a lot. And I said yes. And she kind of looked down when I said that. And I said, do you come here a lot? And she said, yes, but. And she didn't say anything else. And I asked, but what? She said, I don't ever know what to read because there's so much. I'm like, I love that. So, you know, talking with her a little bit, I realized there was so much, but she didn't have a card, so she couldn't take anything out. And I did not have a card, and I don't have a card down there. I usually buy most of my books. And sometime in the next week, I'm getting a card. So when I see her there, she can actually get books out. The whole Sandra Bland thing made me think about that. We need to start taking care of each other. We really do. This system is killing us in so many ways that it really
it drives me to want to do more for us. And I'm hoping as things progress towards 2020 and what have you, that we really take it upon ourselves to lift ourselves up and to be the best black people we can be against this system. That's really it. Thank you, Gus. Thank you, everybody else. Have a good night.
That is wonderful. Black child up with a library card. That is awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. The other folks who dialed in, who have a hand up that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Gus. Greetings, everybody. This is Puff. Have a comment real quick. I have a comment, and then I have a question to Gus. Listening to the Sandra Bland clip, I wanted to say that I thought that was a racist tactic. The white supremacist system has set up. They keep entertaining all these cases, and they give it to a white journalist only to give them prizes and all this type of stuff for their writing off the back of all of these victims of white supremacy. And I thought that, I also thought that, you know, it was conflation of the issue. She started off, you know, talking about Sandra Bland and what led up to her, in my opinion, murder. And then she conflated the issue with depression. It's like, well, depression, what they want you to, you know, what she seems to have wanted you to draw a conclusion of is that Sandra Bland was depressed, therefore she committed suicide in prison. And it's like, well, and see, that's another white supremacy tactic. They wait till people forget about the story to rewrite it. And so they're trying to rewrite this other narrative. It's just the narrative that they're coming up with, you know, after the fact is, you know. And meanwhile, another thing that they do is it's never followed up. Like all these like biographies on the victim and stuff. What about the person that committed the crime? Why aren't there biographies about him? It's like Neela Fuller said on, you know, a college program a long time ago. He was saying, you know, we don't need black history. We don't need black African-American studies. We need white studies. That's what I want to see. I want to see, you know, a biography. Why don't one of the journalists, you know, follow up with this person or whoever committed this crime? It's just like they fade into obscurity and they run off with the, you know, money they collected, you know, from the white people or that they raised or whatever. It's just like they're in a witness protection program or something. It's like crazy. But anyway, I was going to ask Gus a question about the Head Start program. I came into my house kind of a few minutes after that started, and I saw something in the paper a few months ago, you know, that said something about, you know, they were cutting Head Start funding or something like that. What was that about, like that Head Start story? What was that about?
Well, it wasn't about anything happening like contemporary. Basically, it was the history in the state of Mississippi with how white supremacist senators and politicians in the state of Mississippi, they were trying to undermine the Head Start program because you had black people, including like Fannie Lou Hamer's husband, who were working with the Head Start program and trying to use it to teach black people, including teaching them accurate information, not just about black people, about racism. Whites were furious about that, so they were looking at different ways to undermine this program and trying to say, oh, well, they're, you know, stealing money and they're committing fraud, they're, you know, misappropriation of funds and all this other stuff, and then saying that the people that are running this program are not qualified to do this, so they'd had all these audits and all these other means of just practicing racism to undermine the program in the state of Mississippi. That's basically the gist of it. It's based on a book that a black female wrote about this period, 1960s, 70s, that she's talking about in the state of Mississippi. It's not, at least, maybe in the book she might go further than that and talk about contemporary issues, but at least within the clip, she was just talking about this period in history. It was not anything current that's happening.
Mm-hmm. I just hate that they're doing everything, not just the Head Start program, but they're revamping the whole educational system. And these kids here, you know, in Mississippi, I live in Mississippi, in my parents' house at this point. And so it's just hard to see. I mean, the books are being removed from schools and kids can't, you know, take books home. And it's just, the kids' minds are just wild. I mean, you can't even, the discipline problems. I mean, they can't help but to be a discipline problem because they don't have, you know, they can't keep pace of what's going on in class. Because they don't have books, you know, to take home where that's wrote enough, you know, to, you know, do basic things. And it's very, very sad and very hard to watch. And I'll mute my line.
Have you heard?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Hello to guest the host and to all the callers and listeners on the line. Hope that you all are having a great day wherever you're at. Just a few things I want to say. I listened to the piece on Sandra Bland, and actually to me it's just such a very sad piece. You know the college degree, the job situation, not being able to, you know, find a decent job, a full-time job, even, you know, and even willing to, you know, take that chance to move somewhere for what could be, you know, basically like a month job, but, you know, and with probably in her mind, the hopes that it would turn into something longer than that, and even something like, according to what the woman said, you know, to drive all night. You know, so my car, they say, yeah, we want to interview you, you know, tomorrow, and she's driving all night, you know, to get to this place to have this interview. And, you know, the depression, and it's just, it's so sad. And I'll be truthful with you, yeah, I am on Facebook quite a bit, but I mean, I had never, I mean, I don't know why. I mean, in my case, I don't know why, but like she was saying something about her Facebook page, I had never, you know, and had ever crossed her. And then I saw after she passed, you know, I saw, well, after she was murdered. Anyway, you know, I saw a couple of videos of her, and I was just thinking, and I was like, you know, she had just some very, she gave out some very good wisdom, at least a couple of videos that I saw. I was, you know, not that she was there for me, but I was very impressed. But, you know, like saying 28 years old, and I mean, when I was younger, I knew some of that, you know, to have a college degree and, you know, not being able to get that decent paying, we wouldn't even say good paying, just a decent paying, you know, good job so that you can begin to start like your adult life, you know, get your own place, blah, 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 blah. So just listening to that story is just, to me, just very, very sad. And even to say like the depression or, you know, and, you know, sometimes it's just like we're at home with our family and things that could be going on with us that our family it doesn't register, you know. So I was just real sad story. I do agree with Puff what she said about these stories, because that even when I was listening to the story about Head Start, you know, and I said it's and the story about Tennessee, and of course I can't remember what the very first story was about, but you know, and I'm listening to these white people who are basically, quote unquote, telling our story, and yet they're going to tell it, you know. Okay, the story of the woman that they were trying to get the sign. Oh, I think it was Tennessee, my race riots, and when the lady said today, because if you think about race riots today, you think it's what black people burning up where they live at, blah, 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 blah. And so she was just like, no, we want this to show that, you know, this is what white people did, you know. And I agree with you because I had never heard the story in Tennessee. I had never heard of that. And think about all the other hundreds, possibly thousands of stories that's out there like that, of cities where black people had settled in after slavery or what have you, burnt down by white people, you know, because they don't want to see black people with anything. So, you know, I agree with Puff, like you said, because it's always white people telling these stories. At least a lot of time I'm listening, you mean, listen to NPR, you know, some of these other things. There's always some white person who has gone out here and wrote this book. And I think one time when Tommy Curry was on your show, he was on your show, I probably could have read it on Facebook, where he's basically saying that you have blacks who are not majoring in these things. And so these white people are telling our story. And I do know that sometimes that could be hard to tell our story, because when Keith Beauchamp was on your show and he talked about, you know, the sundown towns, and I got the opportunity to see that on the ID channel, and he talked about how he had to basically have those white people with him, you know, at least be able to get some information. And, you know, so I definitely understand what Puff is saying, but I also know, you know, it's kind of like caught between a rock and a hard place for us to do it. But I don't say that because we still should be doing it. And then let me also say this. I'm quite sure that maybe there are some blacks who are writing these stories, but too, they're not getting the TV time or the air time. This is my last quote, my last statement here. The Kamau, Kamau Bell, the comedian, and I didn't see the commercial that I think the retired firefighter member mentioned, but I've been, you know, on Facebook, and so I've been seeing this stuff roll back. CNN is doing this, whatever the title is. But I think the thing that struck me is that I know that this man is a comedian. And I stood up and I'm like, these are serious issues, and yet CNN will hire this comedian and then pay him to go out to get these stories. So if he's out there talking to classes and trying to prove that, oh, you know, they just not like they were, you know, back in the day, I mean, I can see that. Like I said, I'm not watching the series, but, you know, I can see that because it's like, these are serious issues, and you got a comedian out there. And that reminded me of, I think it was after President Obama was reelected, or could have been the first term, and when CNN, remember, they hired D.L. Hughley, and on Saturday night at 10 o'clock, they had him, you know, on some show. I'm like, he's a comedian. And you got him at 10 o'clock at night, you know, trying to discuss serious issues, and he's a comedian. Not saying that he doesn't have an opinion, not saying that he can't discuss, he or D.L. Hughley or Kamau Bell, that they can't discuss these, and not saying that they shouldn't. But why is it that black comedians are hired to do these type of stories, you know, these serious issues, you know, that deal with black people, but you got comedians covering them? Thank you, and I'll meet my line myself.
Just wanted to get in real quick. We did have a couple metaphors slip in there, unfortunately. Rock in a hard place and witness protection program previously, a few metaphors. Anywho, the book, just for Puff, in case you want to do any additional research, the book is that's on the Head Start program in Mississippi. It's called A Chance for Change, Head Start, and Mississippi's Black Freedom Struggle. And the author is Crystal Sanders, black female. She's pretty cute, too, black female. But that will give you more detail. I don't know if it, like I said, if it has anything about what's happening currently with Head Start in Mississippi or anywhere else for that matter. Other folks that we have not heard from, if y'all had a hand up, feel free.
Good evening, everyone. It's Carmen. Good evening, Gus. I so empathize with what Puff was saying about how hard it is to watch them deliberately not teach these children. It's so hard to watch, and they are not going to teach them under any circumstances. But let me see. Yes, thank you for teaching me how to speak, Gus. I used the words that you gave me today. One of the pastors, a white lady, came by to say how they really like this program in the schools. And, you know, last week they got a new thing. They fired the guidance counselor. So they sent all the kids to ISS and in school suspension. And then at 10 o'clock after they counted their heads, you know, how they used to count hands for black people. So now they count heads for the children. After they counted the little heads so they could get paid, they sent them all home. they said, Mom. And then they said, well, no, the parents can't come to the school because we're going to have to get the parents out of control, and we're going to have to get rid of some of these black teachers because they're all troublemakers. And I told the pastor, I said, listen, I don't care if this school closes, because if we have to sacrifice the black parents, black teachers, and black students, I will see this place closed first. So, but she started saying, well, you know, you're not going to be able to call the superintendent racist all these times because she's not racist at all. I said, well, what are you talking about? I never said she was racist. You said she was racist, and then you look at me and ask me not to say it. And I'm going to tell her that you called her racist. So anyway, I wouldn't have known to say that, and I wouldn't have been listening carefully enough because I never said that when I was racist. And it's the Sandra Bland thing. I mean, she just got her dream job. I don't know what people are rewriting and saying. She had just gotten her dream job. This is a great job. There is no way that Miss Bland killed herself. I mean, I see that sheriff. I can count how many fingers go by from every day that I see him. And all the time I've known him, it has never crossed my mind that he wouldn't cover for a homicidal maniac. Of course he would. So I have no reason to believe that if something happened to someone that he wouldn't cover for her. And I have no reason to believe that Miss Bland would kill herself in the jail, not the prison. Also, her records were falsified, and they're still trying to go through those at this time. So, but, you know, no one's doing anything about it, but we're still trying to find someone, because there's two accounts of her death. One said she sat down and hanged herself, and the other one said she hanged herself from a bar. So it's just, there's no way that that woman killed herself, and we've already had complaints of black women going into that jail, and they know that they have been drugged and things, and people have messed with them, and no one has done anything. So, no, I don't believe that Miss Bland killed her.
Karma, are you still with us? Uh-oh. Might have said something she wasn't supposed to. Hopefully she'll dial back in. We can get the remainder of her commentary. Looks like she got disconnected. While we're waiting for her to dial back in, if other folks who have not been able to share yet, if you have commentary that you want to get in, feel free.
May I be heard?
Let's get the caller at 1447 first.
That's me, Gus. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Hey, it's Dwight from Alabama. Hadn't been able to call in live, so I've been listening to the archive. So it's just great to be able to talk with you live, and appreciate the work. Keep up the good work. Got a couple comments. Yeah, I agree with Puff. The Sandra Bland thing, it just came off like they were going to use the depression to kind of justify her killing herself. And the whole article was set up so that we could look at her being depressed, and that would be the trigger as to why she hung herself. So, and I thought that was racist. I listened to NPR today, and they were saying that in 1875, the Kentucky Derby started, and 13 out of the 15 jockeys were African-Americans, and how it was common practice, and I think it was 15 of the 28 first wins were African-American jockeys, and it was something that I didn't know, and I just found it interesting because today they were saying that, you know, no African-American jockeys were in the race. One more comment. I had a friend of mine. He's went to Afghanistan, and he come back, and he was telling me about this transhumanism. And I was thinking, I'm listening to it, and he was telling me about, you know, how these soldiers, to get their arms blown off, they got these arms that connect to the brain, and they can able to move the arm. And so I did my homework. I did a little research and listened to a couple YouTube videos on it. But, you know, it seems to me it was just picking up from where Darwinism left off, eugenics. The same thing Adolf Hitler done, creating this super race. And I told him, I said, now, you know, I believe that. I believe that transhumanism is going to take place. And thanks to the show, Gus, and thanks to you introducing me to Dr. Francis Crest Wilson, it seems like it's just a ploy to white genetic survival. You know, if we're going to create a master race, we're going to make sure that we're able to secure our whiteness and make us be dominant. So, but like I said, just appreciate the show, Gus. Oh, one more comment. Here in Alabama, Governor Bentley proposed a while back for $800 million to build four new state-of-the-art prisons. They lobbied Congress. I guess they wasn't moving fast enough. A little while after that, you had a riot break out at a prison in Atmore. The warden was supposedly stabbed. Governor Bentley ran right back in front of the news cameras and said, you know, more of this will happen if we don't do something about the overcrowded prisons. And shortly thereafter, the money was granted. Just seemed like another ploy to make sure that we got these prisons and keep business as usual. And I don't think a lot of people around here noticed it because we got a lot of confused victims. I'm confused myself, but I'm learning. And thanks to you guys, I appreciate it. That's all I have to say. I'll mute myself.
For sure. The caller at 9039. Did you have commentary you wanted to get in?
Can I be heard?
Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Is that better?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. Comments. I got a few comments. I was listening, you know, listening to the Sandra Bland clip, I felt the same way as some of the other callers felt about just a white racist woman, you know, racist white woman taking advantage of a situation, knowing in a few months or a year or whatever it is, the count is, she'll get some award, be graciously applauded, and, you know. Away from, and I viewed it the same way. And as you always say, it was fascinating. Very, very fascinating how this thing keeps going. I was intrigued by listening to the South Memphis clip, and just, oh man, I get angry a lot of times because I understand two things. You didn't teach me something, but you did teach me something. Speaking of school, speaking of, you know, education 1 through 12, K through 12 or whatever, and everything, even after that, unless it's, you know, most HBCUs or whatever, but just being taught something so wrong, you know, to who I am and to what I am, you know what I mean? I'm black. I'm a black man. You know, I'm a descendant of slaves. My ancestors were Africans, and just to know all the things that they've gotten away with, just murder, the heinousness, the crimes, just, and they sing songs about it. They have odes and you know, different kind of coded language that they speak in around each other to glorify it, and statues and figurines and everything else. And I'm just, you know, I'm waking up like a lot of us are. I'm just now waking up. I've been on this journey a little while, just hearing all of these things. I'm just like, again, I found it fascinating that something this heinous went on, and it was, I never heard about it. I've done a lot of reading, a lot of TV watching as well. Never heard about it. And it was never pushed on to me. You understand what I'm saying? Like, I could have went and searched for it myself, but I didn't know something like this would ever go on and not be televised and talked about. Also, I'm not sure if it was a day or whenever it was, but I saw a clip of an African woman. I think it was in Sweden. An African woman. They were having some kind of neo-Nazi, march, meeting, whatever it was, but they were there going through the streets, marching through the streets, and this one black woman, I guess it was other protesters there as well, but I guess she just went out into the street and just took a stance around, it was, I guess, 300 of them, and just took a stance and threw her arm up, and I screenshot it, and I looked at it, and I'm just understanding, and I want all the callers to understand that, which they probably already do, that all of this, all of these things that these Europeans have done, the houses, buildings, the network, the religion, everything, the same way that they use these things to our detriment, to hurt us, to kill us and other things, if we pay attention to all of it, all of the points of human activity, pay attention to it and learn it, even the stupid shows that come on TV, all everything, the churches, everything, you can see how to turn it against them, build the code, and turn it against them to start breaking them down secretly or start building, you know what I mean? Understand what it is that you're in and start to use it to your advantage. And I don't know, man. Those were some awesome clips. And I guess I'll step off on that. I'll mute my line. Thanks, guys.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I just wanted to get in because I don't remember the person was. I, you know, would give out credit. I just don't. I'm a victim of racism. Forgive me. But I know when there was a clip that we played a ways back, but it was about Khalif Browder, the black male who committed suicide after he had been wrongfully detained for, like, years. And it was this white person who did this long report and got all this attention and, oh, you're just, you know, the greatest person in the history of life. And, you know, it's so amazing that you did this report and blah, 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 and just the same type of thing. And they were bringing up within that context that they really wish that more frequently, if something happened to a black person, particularly if we're going to be talking about reporting on racism, that they would be getting that information from black journalists, black people being the ones to do those stories as opposed to whites coming in and doing the stories. I even know with Miriam Carey, it's white people. It was a white person for the Washington Post who did a pretty massive write-up talking about what happened to her, the black mother who was shot and killed in D.C. in 2013. Even though her attorney, Eric Sanders, he did say that, in his opinion, there have not been enough black journalists to step up to talk about this case to try to get out information about Miriam Carey specifically. But I know that's something that people have brought up quite a few times on this program before, specifically about it'll be a black person victimized, maybe even killed, and then white people will swoop in to get all their Pulitzers and everything else for talking about the incident. Anybody that we missed, anybody who dialed in who has not had an opportunity to share? I don't see Karma on the line. I don't know if she was not able to dial back in or she had some phone difficulties. I wanted to make sure we got her in before we get to workplace racism. We have about 5 minutes. If we missed anybody, you should speak now. If not, if anybody had anything else that they wanted to get in, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Just a quick suggestion for something to kind of study, or truthfully, I think it's a good piece to study. I listened to a podcast called Best of the Left, actually, Best of the Left podcast. And episode 947 is about the political mess that came out of last year's Netroots Nation confrontation between Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter activists. There is a clip in this entire collage of clips, because that's what the podcast is, about 40 minutes in, which really demonstrates some of the confusion within the middle-class black community, but also the clarity that some people were starting to actually see and yet didn't want to admit. It's a fascinating, absolutely fascinating piece of work that honestly most of us would probably appreciate if we listened to. That's all. Thank you very much.
Mr. Fuller does recommend not using the term middle class. I second that. The only class is whites, everybody else is just victims of racism. But folks can check that podcast out if there's any constructive information. Certainly people have their own views about that. Anybody else? I thought I had one other person.
Yes, Gus, it was me. It's Ross. I had two things I just wanted to say. There's an article I'm going to send you, but recently white people have developed what they're calling artificial wombs, and this also speaks to white genetic annihilation as well. So I'm going to send you that article later on tonight. And then lastly, a couple weeks ago, one of the callers brought up, I think it was on a compensatory call-in, the legal definition of a citizen. And I hadn't read this in a long time, but is this something I think everyone should really pay attention to? The third definition says all natives are not citizens of the United States. Descendants of the Aborigines and those of African origin are not entitled to the rights of citizens. Anterior to the adoption of the Constitution of the United States, each state had the right to make citizens of such persons as it pleased. That Constitution does not authorize any but white persons to become citizens of the United States, and it must therefore be presumed that no one is a citizen who is not white. That is part of the legal definition for what it is to be a citizen of the United States. Just wanted to put that out there. Thank you so much for taking my call, guys.
Did that get amended?
I'm not sure.
I think that got amended.
It did, okay.
Yeah, because we talked about
it. I'm sorry.
It is important, but I think we talked about that in White by Law with Ian Hani Lopez, where he talks about it took a long time for them to actually change that in terms of you have to be white to be a citizen. It's certainly super significant, but I think they did eventually get around to amending that.
That's interesting because the way things play out, it plays out exactly how it's written. So even if it was amended, we're still living that reality right now. So, hey, to me, that just... the paper change means nothing. The white psychopathology is what we live every day.
For sure. We will transition to workplace racism. Folks have commentary that they would like to share. Feel free to chime in. The number again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Listeners wrote in several things I will try to share quickly before I get to folks that are on the line. First one, I listen to all of your programs, usually pre-recorded podcasts during my lunch break. During my lunch break in my car or en route to one of my three jobs. Whew. I'm soon going to be cutting back to two jobs to maintain my black mental health. Outstanding. The good news is that all three jobs offer me the opportunity to constructively help black people, even though anti-blackness prevents them sometimes from wanting the help. I have shared a few times on the program. However, due to being severely traumatized throughout my life by whites, I find it extremely difficult to share exactly what is on my mind in a clear and concise way. To be honest, I have a fear that white people will take what little I do have in one instant, home, career, college degrees, and everything else I have worked so hard for. This fear has also been passed down to me from my older family members who have experienced complete loss and devastation by white people. Anyway, I am writing in to report that I heard a discussion recently between my manager and a coworker where the manager said the word cows in a discussion he was having with our coworker. I heard this discussion and thought to myself that either they looked at my phone when I may have stepped away from my desk abruptly, or that they overheard me listening to this program in my car during lunch, or that the one black coworker friend who works in another office told them. My guess is that I mistakenly forgot to change my phone screen before leaving my locked phone on my desk. By the way, I'm usually very meticulous and guarded with the little privacy that I do have at this job. I also rarely listen to the cows while working due to the fact that I really like to pay attention to the details of what is being said on the program. Lately, I've been paying extra attention to locking up my desk and taking my phone with me when using the restroom or leaving the office to make a call. Even though my white coworkers look at me like I am crazy for locking everything up for the few minutes I am away from the desk. However, my feelings of mistrust and discomfort are valid and based on my own traumatic learning experience with past white coworkers, white students, and former white friends who have lied, manipulated, and mistreated me in some kind of way. I am also the only black person in an office of white people who appear to be watching and paying attention to my every move, which also adds to my discomfort there. On top of that, my white female coworkers are very nosy. Imagine that. And to the point where I have caught them following me out in the hall when I have had to take a call. They also gossip and whisper to each other. About me, how I don't wash my hair every day, how I refuse to eat lunch with them, and how they don't know much about me. They also have inundated me with personal questions ranging from what my address is to how much I pay each month for housing to wanting to know my salary. Since I truly believe in focusing on solutions, here are a few counter-racist workplace solutions I apply regularly. Number one, when working around white people at work, use a watch device that measures your heart rate. If it is high, past 95 plus, try to lower it by taking deep breaths and or thinking about something pleasant. Listening to the cows during lunch keeps one reminded that war is being raged against black people and that it is important to remain codified at all times. Number three, build rapport with other black coworkers who could give you references should you have to leave the job under unpleasant circumstances. Next, contribute as much as you can towards a war chest and or 401k in the event that racists make it impossible for you to collect unemployment. Next, get a second job that would allow you to increase your hours in the event that you lost your primary job. Next, when you're having to talk to white coworkers, pop up at their desk. They seem to feel uncomfortable when you are in their space on your terms. Next, cultivate other skills so that you can apply for other temp jobs if needed in an emergency. Next, guard your mental health by staying away from white foods altogether. These include white sugar, white flour products, white rice, white bread, soda, candy, etc. These things are proven to alter mood and also hinder clear thinking. Next, make sure to get enough sleep. Racists work overtime when they know we are tired and or not thinking straight. Lastly, as far as my situation, I am prepared and expecting the worst case scenario. If your job finds out that you listen to the cows or that you are unpleased with how white racists are mistreating you, you have the right as a human being not to like the mistreatment and to question it. The shame of being a victim should be put back on the person and or people who are mistreating the victim. Outstanding. Always grand to have suggestions and codification for dealing with racism in the workplace. All right, we had one more workplace racism update. And this is this female caller. She's dialed in before dealing with this racist white woman who hugs her on the job. She's tried to make it clear that she does not want to be hugged. I think she even tried to codify a response and saying, you know, I'm a mom. And, you know, we had a really tough flu season last year. So I'm really trying to minimize the amount of, you know, contact and touching that I do. So I'm not passing germs on to my child and everything. And it seemed like the race soldier got even more sinister about things. She would wait and come up behind her and hug her when she, you know, wasn't prepared, couldn't see her, so she couldn't, you know, defend herself adequately. So she wanted to give us an update. Here we go. Wanted to provide an update to you and the callers about the woman in my office who has insisted on hugging. I will tell you that the hugs have decreased substantially because of a number of reasons. She only works part-time. She has been out much of that time with personal illness, and when she is in the office, she is often busy socializing with other staff. So the other day, one of the first times we have been in the office together in weeks, she asks me for some figures related to one of her projects. I comply, and she then proceeds to hug me as a thank you. I never hug back and just stand there stiff and uncomfortable and, frankly, very embarrassed. She then proceeds to turn to my office mate and say, I know she hates those hugs. I tell her, yes, I do. I don't know why you keep giving them to me. Then she says to me, or possibly my white office mate, you know, I just went to supervisor ethics training last week, and they told us we aren't supposed to hug people because they could report it as sexual harassment. I told her, yeah, I know. And then she says, well, I'll just lean in and pretend I am hugging you then. I told her I don't like that either, and she kind of giggled and walked away. Later, I'm getting ready to leave for the day, and I go to the copier to copy something before I walk out, and the hugger walks up behind me as I turn around and pretends she is going to engage me in an embrace and then says, just kidding. She then turns to the receptionist whose desk we are near and says, she hates hugs. And I say again, yes, I do. I do not like to be touched. And I walk out of the office for the day. I heard you mention the other day that you weren't sure why people don't seem to be as interested in sharing during workplace racism as, say, Area 8. The callers mentioned some very valid reasons that I would admit play a part for me, but one thing I don't think anyone mentioned is what makes it hardest for me. For me, much of my apprehension in terms of sharing during workplace is shame. I know I should be more firm or be more assertive and tell this woman exactly how I feel and what will happen if she continues this behavior, but honestly, I freeze up. I have never been a particularly confrontational person and, as a result, have often been victimized in criminal and unspeakable ways by whites as a result. It's embarrassing and shameful that as an adult woman, I feel crippled to speak up for myself or to act in a manner that protects myself. Although the hugging decreased, it still would happen periodically, and from time to time, my husband would ask me about it. In those instances, I would either change the subject or lie about it because I felt that my inability to speak up for myself would make my husband think I was weak or cowardly. I didn't want my inability to speak up about this to make him think that I would be unable to speak up for our son or allow our son to be mistreated by white people. So I just stopped bringing it up because I hadn't resolved it or been able to act in a manner that made me feel proud. And honestly, I just hoped it would stop on its own. Although I have overheard the woman talk about finding other employment if this job won't give her full time, I realize how naive that hope is. This, as well as other abuses I have suffered at the hands of white people, weighs on my mind heavily. I toggle between thoughts that they are just hugs and why make an issue out of an otherwise drama-free workplace. But another part of me can't let it go and doesn't want to simply go along to get along anymore. Anyhow, that's my update and my conflict. So as I said, I can't speak for everyone, but for me, that is why I have refrained from sharing. I regret that I haven't managed to resolve this issue on my own and provide someone else with some guidance, but I would love to learn if shame plays a part for anyone else and if that could contribute to why they may not share. Outstanding. Outstanding. I am in 1,000% agreement. I suspect shame plays a huge role. I think even Mr. Fuller has said pretty regularly that black people become embarrassed when talking honestly about racism, because generally it is not a very proud, fun thing to talk about how you have been terrorized and abused by white people. I mean, that is not fun at all. It's embarrassing, and then to have to share this with people, whether they're strangers or even worse with people that, you know, care about you, whether it's your children, spouse, partner, friends, whatever the case may be. It is horrendous. I'm even reminded of, again, Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns. A lot of that book where she's talking to these black people who are much, much older, 70s, 80s, some even older than that. And a lot, they're talking about workplace racism. Even Ida Mae Gladney, she's talking about being sexually terrorized by this white brute. Where she's working in his house for a day on a temporary basis. And a lot of these victims said that they hadn't talked about this stuff in decades, that they had never talked about it to anyone for, I suspect, those exact reasons. I'm sure there are other things that contribute to it, but I think just the shame and embarrassment and just not feeling proud that, you know, we weren't able to respond in a better manner, that we weren't able to do more, to feel like, yeah, I was on the job and I was, you know, spirit of General Harriet Tubman. I told them what for and put it down and blah, 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 and all that. I mean, white people have a lot of power over us, you know, to, as the previous caller who wrote in said, to be able to take away your job, house, a lot of things, to make things very unstable, insecure for us. And I think just being honest about that can go a long way. But I just will again encourage, try to be, I think we all try to be very supportive and nurturing when we get to workplace racism, keeping all that in mind, how difficult it is for victims of racism, particularly on the job. And I think this is incredibly important because so many of us are experiencing the exact same thing. I think that can be very, very helpful in dealing with all this, realizing that it's not just you, that whites are doing the exact same thing to thousands of black people worldwide every day, and that there are, in fact, some strategies that can be employed to try to minimize some of this stuff. That's the goal, that's the hope, and that's why I think it's important to try to work through and share, even though it is certainly not the most proud thing to talk about, how you've been terrorized. But I will stop there. Folks have commentary on what either of the folks who wrote in, what they had to share, or if you have your own instances of workplace racism you want to share, feel free.
Greetings, can I beard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Bronx caller. Right now I work with my family, and so there's not really anybody but black people around. Only a small handful of people, and usually I'm working alone on a task, so workplace racism doesn't really come into play right now. But When I lived in Denver a few years back, I can relate. I'll be quick. That's an interesting sequence of events. The people I worked around. I was working with this guy. I worked at a deli kind of counter kind of thing. It was just like some kind of, you know, kind of fresh salad bar kind of restaurant thing. It's called Panera. It was something like that, though. So I was working with some people. I became friends with one guy in particular, a white guy. And actually, I ended up staying with him sometimes because I was kind of in and out of the place where I was at. And then I ended up getting fired from this job because I sent a text message to this girl that we were working with. I told her F off in the text message, right? And it was kind of like, it was half joking, and it was somebody that I had a rapport with outside of work. We had hung out outside of work. So it was kind of like, I don't know, she was kind of ignoring me or something. And is this white, you know, suspected racist female, you know, the dangers of interacting with white females. So I sent her this text message, you know, she's kind of ignoring my text, and I was just like, F off or whatever. And I go to work. And my boss, this like, you know, a guy, he comes up to me, he's all talking about this text message, and he's like, you know, who do you text like that? And I'm like, well, you know, it's between her and I, you know, it wasn't really anything big, and I got fired there. So I go into this, I was unemployed for a while, going to another job. I found this, actually, it was a really good fit. It was a vegan restaurant. And it was a place where I'd eaten a lot, in Denver. So it was a really good fit. And, And so this guy that I was working with before, who I had stayed with sometimes, he had actually been on felony probation in a whole other state. Apparently he'd done all this crazy stuff, and he had ended up getting off with this felony probation for, like, this stuff he could have gone down for, like, I don't know, a very long time. It was like he had some pretty substantial charges against him. So I work at this new job, right? And then I'm there for a couple months or whatever. And then this guy, Corey, whatever, his name was Corey. So the Corey comes and he comes to work at this place too. So I'm like, whoa, oh my gosh, Corey, like, so he's working there too. And, I experienced a lot of racism at this other place, this vegan restaurant. I wasn't expecting it per se, although I know how white people are. They have, you know, these really, benevolent images, you know, white people, you imagine that they're, you know, seeking justice for animals and gay people and, you know, black people and whatnot. But, you know, really it's all just a front, and they're very, you know, petty and, you know, cruel and racist, whatever. So like, you know, like, I don't know, my first few days on the job, my actual supervisor, he was several years younger than me, always telling us about how he's going out on the weekends, taking acid and, you know, I don't know, snorting cocaine and stuff, you know, going to some hippie shows. So this guy, like, he like messes up some order, and then he screams, calls himself a nigger, you know, and he storms out to smoke a cigarette. And I'm like, this was like my first few days on the job. This guy's like screaming nigger and, like, you know, in anger. And, like, I don't know, he, I don't know, these people that, I was there for months. I had people, like, complaining to the boss that I was working too hard to make them look bad, and I don't know. I think a lot of these experiences, these experiences kind of made me kind of head towards being self-employed, like, as a bottom line. Even at that point, it was kind of a dream job for me, being a vegan and everything. But even at that point, I was like, this isn't good enough. I need to just get completely away from, you know, this social system, you know, as far as, like, where I need to be in it for 8 hours a day. So anyway, I'm Corey. So Corey's working there. And then this incident ended up happening where he was dating this girl that worked there. And so-called Hispanic, I think she would be classified as non-white female. He ended up beating her, like, one night. I wasn't there, but I heard that he started beating her up. Like, he had had a few drinks after work. He starts beating, this is a young guy too, young, you know, hip, like, you know, kind of like in music scene, like, you know, vegans and whatnot. This guy just beats this girl all savagely, and then his roommate has to come and beat him up. He wakes up in the hospital, like, you know, like, handcuffed, like, with no memory of what happened. And, of course, he got fired. And I don't know, I don't even think he went to jail or anything. I think his probation just got, like, reinstated or something. But, I don't know. That was just a mess. That was pretty much, yeah. That was, some Denver Chronicles, so. I don't know. I'll leave it there for now.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I'm not surprised. I'll only say white women are extremely dangerous. We've talked about, emphasized that before. Whites, period, on the job are dangerous. You certainly don't want to be functioning as though these are your pals and homies in the workplace situation. People that dialed in more recently that we might not have heard from at all, if you all had commentary that you wanted to share, last four digits, 9315, 9516, 0889. The folks that dialed in more recently that we have not heard from, if y'all had commentary, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Let's get...
Go ahead. Let the other guy go. Go ahead and speak.
Hello, is that me?
Yes, sir. Speak up, please.
Okay, for sure. So, as you guys know, or may or may not know, I'm a car salesman. So, but I'm in, like, the valley of Los Angeles. So a lot of like writers and directors and stuff, like buy cars from us. So anyway, the guy who wrote the movie 187, so he came and bought a car today. And I just happened to be in the office, and I overheard him talking to one of the salesmen. He was like, you know, yeah, I wrote the movie 187. And then he was like, I know I don't look like, you know, he's a white dude. So he's like, yeah, I know I don't look like I would write a movie like that. He was like, but I'm a teacher. So I had never heard about the movie 187. So I Googled it real quick. And then I looked, you know, it had like Samuel Jackson or whatever. And it's about like basically some Mexican kids trying to kill, like some Mexican kids from the valley trying to kill the teacher. And I'm like, and this dude is like, this guy was a teacher, and this is how he viewed the people that he was teaching. So that's all I had.
Oh,
that's pretty hilarious. Not surprising, but that's pretty hilarious. The other caller that was going to share, did you have commentary you wanted to get in as well?
Yeah, Gus, I was listening to, I guess, what you were saying earlier, I guess. Well, you know, in the workplace as a black person, I tell you, one thing that I was taught always for years is on the job, never leave any food unattended, never leave any drinks unattended, and always, you know, never bring anything personal. Your computer screen, you should always lock it out. You know, there's a, you know, the lobby, you have to punch in the code to get into it. And, you know, and bring your book bags, you know, because I tell you, I document everything I do on the job. I have a diary. It's extensive. I mean, I document what white person comes into my office, the day and time, what they do, what they talk about, everything. So I don't leave. When I leave that office, that thing leaves with me, you know, because white people, they are incredibly nosy. They will go through your stuff. If, you know, if they know that there's nobody in there, they will, you know, go through your stuff and read it. And, you know, I don't trust, and it's another rule I have, I don't trust any white folks on the job. I don't care how friendly they are to you or the kind that never speaks to you. I don't trust any of them because I've seen this for years. You know, white people, the most dangerous ones, is the ones that you had mentioned, the ones that come, that are real talkative to you, the ones that come, you know, smiling in your face, the ones that want to hug you. Those are the main ones. When your back is turned, they'll cut your throat. You know, they'll get together in a group, and, you know, they'll try to get in your business. And how white people get you is they'll they want to see what you do, you know, watch you, and then they'll go behind your back and, you know, write the boss a letter or email the higher-ups and, you know, and have all those, you know, phony allegations against you. And also, too, I think that your best friend, like I said, is you have to document everything. And one of the biggest mistakes that I see black people do, even on my job, is they give a white person to come in there, try to be friendly, and they try to give all their personal business out. You know, they talk about their family. You know, I had a friend, she's a secretary. I said, that's the main thing you should never do. I said, the whites you talking to, they'll cut your throat. They just want to find out about you and find out ways they can harm you. I said, I keep it strictly business with them. In the office, I don't laugh with white folks. I don't tell them any of my business. I keep it strictly business. I don't go to their, you know, their, when they have, oh, we're going to have a luncheon for the secretary, a retirement, I don't go. I don't even show up. I know they're talking about it, but, hey, I don't care. And also, too, like I said, your best friend is you have to document. You have to be real concise when you, you know, the time you come in, you know, what you did last night to jog your memory, what you worked on, how many times, you know, they called you, what projects they gave you. because I don't know if you know, if white people are watching you when you come in or what time you leave, I document that because, you know, that's a form of workplace harassment there. You can go to your, you know, if, you know, you can go to your state, I guess, office, and you could file charges if it got to the point where, you know, they're writing the boss and trying to get you fired, you know. But, you know, you have to have, you know, your documentation and you and a witness, but you probably won't get that because white people aren't going to help you against other whites and black people or other victims. I wouldn't want to put them in harm's way. So, you know, that's my comment. That's all I had.
Amen on documentation. Amen. Are there other folks that have not shared at all for workplace racism? Do you have anybody on the line who hasn't shared at all who wanted to comment on workplace racism?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. I thought you had commented before. I'm just making sure we didn't miss anybody who hasn't been able to speak at all. Anybody that we haven't heard from at all?
You haven't heard from me at all.
Oh, my bad. I'm sorry. I thought you were our caller in Ohio. Go ahead, ma'am. Sorry about that.
No, I'm a caller in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Oh, right on. Right on. Good to hear from you.
I'm a new caller. I just wanted to make a comment on workplace racism. What I do is I wear headphones and, like, I'll listen to the show or I'll listen to music. And so that's cut down on people at work even talking to me. So there was an older gentleman. He would always come to me and the other black lady that worked there, and he would always tell us about some black restaurant that he went to, or he once told us that there was a moving company in Detroit called Two Niggers in a Truck. He thought we would be interested in hearing about that. Just anything that has anything to do with him interacting with black people, he feels the need to want to tell us about it. So I just started wearing my headphones, so that just cut down on lots of conversations that I have with people there, white people. I don't want to talk to them. I'll talk to a few black people that work there, but the white people I don't go out of my way to talk to. And that's all I had to say. Thank you.
Was that, like, serious, or was this a joke? The two niggers in a truck, was that, like...
He said it was... serious. He said it was somebody in Detroit, one of his black friends that he knows that he was in the military with, sent him a link or something on his phone and said that this was a real company in Detroit called Two Niggers in a Truck.
Huh. Okay. That is, that is wild. But I totally agree. Whether it's legit or not, I totally agree with that suggestion, just trying to minimize the tackiness so that you don't have to deal with them coming up and giving you random stuff like that and just to engage you, because I feel like they just try to engage in any sort of tackiness where they can be racist under the guy. Oh, we were just talking. I was just telling you about this. I thought you would find it interesting. That, so anything that you can do to minimize that sort of unnecessary fraternizing, A plus.
Thank you.
For sure. Anybody that we haven't heard from at all have commentary they wanted to get in, workplace racism?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
How you doing? Because it's Sam from Compton, California. I work for a local school district here in L.A. County. I'm a resource officer for the district, and I won racism survey. I work at a high school, continuation school, and where kids who fall off in their regular school, they come there and do catch-up work. And they have a PE teacher there, a white guy. And we had an incident where, I guess during PE time, during the kids, most of the kids are black or are non-white, Hispanic. So I guess the teacher came to work one day, and I guess he had some shorts on, and I guess he was kind of exposed or something like that. And it got out. I guess a kid went and told the principal. So the point, it's crazy how white folks don't get in trouble at work, is that the principal, which is non-black also, had another teacher just go talk to him about it. You know, I guess one of the kids in his privates or whatever. But what I find strange is that there's a black teacher there who I've been knowing for years, working with since the 90s. He got reprimanded for saying a curse word at a kid. But I was saying, wow, y'all trying to fire him and put a dig on his credential for saying a swear word, probably on accident. But y'all know this guy here was doing PE with his privates exposed. And nothing happened, you know. And I just find that strange, you know. I find it strange. That's all I want to say. Thanks, guys.
Wow. Not surprising. Cynical African, I'm sure, would enjoy getting more of the details, but I'm sure he would also submit that is pretty typical within this system. I saw the report this week. I guess this would be workplace racism, too, where they said that Joe Paterno up at Penn State, that he knew about Jerry Sandusky's child rape dating back to the 70s. Now, he just got convicted, you know, a couple years back, but that he knew about this, I guess that would be like 35 years before all this came out. I think all this came out in 2011 when he got arrested and everything, but that he had known about this for a long time and had just chose to not do anything, that sort of thing tends to happen frequently with these sexual predators. You can just juxtapose that with the treatment that black people get for anything, perceived infraction or even a manufactured, totally made-up infraction, where we're written up, fired, terminated, the whole nine. Other folks have commentary. If you have thoughts on what folks have shared thus far, if you have your own incidents, feel free.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes.
I guess we'll get Thomas in New York first.
Oh, yeah, this is quick. I've been listening, and of course, you know, when I heard two niggas in a truck, I had to Google it. And what came up was a whole joke page called Two Niggas in a Stolen Truck. And I wonder if that was the setup, you know, whole bunch of Pinterest and USA article. I think someone named Ted Nugent was the person that made this meme, Two Niggas in a Stolen Truck, with two dudes, two Africans with spears in their hands on the truck. And it's just tackiness. I can't find any business called Two Niggas in a Truck in Detroit. All that comes up is Two Niggas in this Stolen Truck meme. And I think that the guy was practicing racism.
Retired firefighter, were you going to share as well?
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the first person that wrote in their workplace racism experience, and I really feel sorry for the lady, I believe it was, in her dilemma, and that's how I process it. Because ultimately, it's going to keep happening, this misadventure, until either that white person gets tired of it themselves. I think she mentioned about getting sick or whatever. And I mean, what I think about it, she did get worse than getting sick. Or something else, you know, other than what she has not been doing, because the real answer to it, from my experience, is to deal with it immediately when it takes place. Something like that takes place, something that you don't like happening to you, that is being done to you by another person, and it's not necessarily have to be just a white person either. It could be a non-white black person in the workplace. And a lot of times a non-white black person would do it to elicit favor from white people. Clowning around with you, touching you in some kind of way. Someone made, I had a bald head for the most part when I was employed. And somebody made a mistake of touching my head one day, and I tried to break their arm. I really didn't care what was the result that may have happened from it. It was a reaction, as far as that concerned. I would have played self-defense, of course, but nevertheless, nothing happened from it, and the person got the message from that standpoint. Other than that, the job that I was on had a different nature. Although there were females on the job, it wasn't a whole lot of females, and it was still a male-dominated, male-cultured type of atmosphere. So the whole idea, it's just some people you know not to mess with. And I would like to think that I was one of those type of people when I was working. And there's been a few people that have come up to you and want to say something or touch you in some kind of way. And like I said before, what I did was, I would give a look or I would actually would grab their hand or do something that would get them to understand that, hey, that's not going to happen again. That's not going to happen again at all. It kind of like dissipated because white people are very aggressive, especially white females. They're also aggressive too. I noticed from the job, from the standpoint of they would like to try to imply that I'm a friendly person, or I'm just a friendly person, an outgoing person, and by me touching you, it kind of like gives you I want to give you that impression. But that kind of stuff been going on as far back as when we were really on the plantation. And they use it for the same reasons also, for some sort of impromptu entertainment. And to try to make themselves look like they are I'm down to the level with the slaves type of thing. You have that type of thing have to be, and I'm maybe talking to somebody who really have got to that point that they can see it coming. If it happens, you gotta deal with that immediately. Because actually what it is it actually is a form of bullying. It's a form of bullying, and that can continuously happen until that person gets tired, as far as that's concerned. Or, if you want to, go through the system as far as paperwork is concerned, that also would be important from the standpoint you have something of a legal document to go back on if it gets to a situation to whereas they try to make it a he said, she said type of thing. You would have, the down on paper that you actually took it to wherever your job suggested you should do, that's what I had to say. My phone is about to go dead. Thank you.
For sure. I know we had Mr. Fuller. I asked him about the hugging situation because she's shared about this for a while now. And I think we had Mr. Edward Williams on the program during last year, and he also gave his thoughts on this situation. I know Mr. Fuller, he was very much advocating immediately, back up. That means you need to put your hand up, give me 10 feet. I can't do all that. Like, just make that very clear. And if this person persists, that would be the response every time. I would be running from this person, just every time if they came up from behind immediately, like, hey, if I need to give a forearm, like, get up off me. I do not do all that in the workplace. Like, we're supposed to be professional. We're supposed to be business. And, I'm not doing all this touching and what have you. That would be the response he would give every time. And that's one of the ones, I think I mentioned it, the program on Wednesday, about if people are interested in doing the role play, where you can kind of role play these scenarios, because I know for a lot of us, just because we've been victimized, and it's not white privilege, it's white power, that it can be frightening, it can be intimidating to tell a white person no. That's in Renethia Tate's book. I know Pam has talked about that. Black people have died for having the audacity, having the courage and black self-respect to challenge a white person on anything. So I certainly understand. But I think if you can role play scenarios where you just try that and you can get comfortable so you can do it in your voice, where you don't have to yell and curse at the person, but you can just be firm and respond appropriately. Business place, hey, you know, I'm Sharon. I know you're just trying to be friendly and all, but I really don't do a lot of unnecessary touching in the workplace. I've tried to make that clear to you. Don't touch me, and back up, arm raise, or whatever you want to do at the same time, and just get in the habit. You can try it out a few times. I think she might have even said that she had tried that before, but I mean, just really practicing that and getting comfortable with it, so it'll be really natural on the job when you try that sort of situation out, so that they get the message that you're not going to tolerate this anymore. Just make that really clear. I know that was Mr. Fuller's suggestion from a while back as well. Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say for the sister who was talking about the two niggas in the truck, I think I don't know if she did, but if she didn't, just document that situation and any other situations where he might bring up something race related, or anything else that's uncomfortable, that, you know, just document that. And then what you were just talking about in reference to it just slipped my mind.
Hugging.
Oh, yes. As far as the hugging and inappropriate touching, I was going to say the person should really look into the sexual harassment statutes of her company's policy, because every place that I've worked, they've, like Thomas has talked about before, they've shown videos about what's considered sexual harassment. They make you sign documentation, and that includes unwanted and or inappropriate touching. So if the person does not want to be hugged and they make that known to you and you continue to violate that person's space and touch them, that is something they should be able to move forward with as far as sexual harassment or some form of inappropriate behavior, because that's something that should be on the company policy. I don't know any company that does not have that. And they also exclusively say unwanted touching, meaning the person who's receiving the touching is saying, no, I do not like this, please do not do so, and the person is perpetrating a violation of that person's rights. So I just wanted to put that out there.
I think the race soldier in this incident, even as she was violating this black female, acknowledged that she just went to training where this was covered, and it was covered as inappropriate conduct, sexual harassment, unethical behavior, doing this, and laughed as she continued doing, which for me just further solidifies that this is total white terrorism. She knows exactly what she's doing, and she's doing this deliberately to terrorize and sexually abuse this black female.
And it kind of reminds me of the book where the guy was forced to go through the jaw surgery, and then the doctor cut him so he had a permanent grin on his face, and then he laughed about it afterwards. It reminds me of that. That's immediately what I thought about. And it's like this gleeful enjoyment of the suffering of a black person. So yeah, if you can look into that as far as this person violating your space, and if there's other people who bore witness to her touching you, with you asking her not to, I don't know if you have it documented, but if that's the case, just bring all that documentation to the fore and call on the carpet for it, because there should be company policy, and she's violating that, and she's gleefully doing so. So she's doing so at your peril and causing you, all kinds of sufferation on the job. So I wish you the best with that, because that's a really hella situation to deal with.
I was just going to say, like, that I was just thinking about how, like, at the job where I was just talking about some nightmare, some experiences at the job where I was working, like, you know, Gus talks about don't go to office parties and stuff. And, the office party at that job where I was at, we were all drinking and cops got called. And actually this girl actually got sexually assaulted, a non-white female got sexually assaulted by a white guy. But, I mean, like, now it's like, you know, LGBTQ, you know, people all want to be treated equally. So you don't even know whether it's a sexual advance or not, you know. So, I mean, I've never heard of a workplace where being hugged was at all appropriate. So, you know, just to put that there.
I think that's at least the second time that we have heard of alcohol at an office party, and enforcement officials had to be called, and things got that out of control. Just that would be another great illustration of number one, sobriety would be best. Number two, I would avoid those office parties if you can. Again, I know some people are required to go. We talked about that as well. Codify if you got to go, or if you feel like, you know, you need to make an appearance for 30 minutes or whatever the case may be, just to make sure that you don't, you know, get in any unnecessary trouble on the job. But if you do not have to be present, I would pass on all of those, because that's, as I said, at least the second time that we have heard of things getting that ridiculous with alcohol and coworkers. Before we conclude, anybody else have anything, workplace racism, they want to make sure they got in?
Have you heard?
Yes, sir, if you could speak up.
Yes, can you hear me now, Gus?
That is an improvement.
Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. Just a few observations from the week. I had a few conversations with the white male who I've been studying for a while now. He said he went to a protest downtown, and I guess they were still talking about the Confederate statue that's located down there, and he just said he wanted to ask me. He said, I walked up to this protester, and she had a sign called Black Lives Matter. So he asked her, and he was like, well, shouldn't it be All Lives Matter? And then he told me the lady started cussing him out, you know, and that was pretty much that was that first incident. And then it was two white females, I guess, gossiping about somebody. Apparently it was a person who used to work in our department, like an older white lady. And I found out that it's like this pattern where if two white people might be having like some kind of feud or dispute, they, like, one of the white people will somewhat, I guess, reveal that the other white person is practicing racism, or will somewhat label them a racist, because she said, oh, yeah, this person, she made sure when blank, she said my name when blank was in the room, that she held disgust for the Martin Luther King holiday, and she rather come to work and stay at home. And the other white girl, you know, she's standing next to me, she like blushing, you know, turning red like she ashamed, and she wasn't even talking to her. So I guess she had problems with this other white lady. So that was the second one. And the third was this white woman, she was asking, like, how could she send like an envelope to the other courthouse building? And she wanted to send it to this black judge and his assistant, who was also a black female. And it was a newspaper article about a swearing, I think it's swearing the mayor for our town. And it had like one. She wanted me to read the article, and it started out talking about, I guess, how the town had its roots in slavery and whatnot. And I guess she wanted them to read it. So, but before she asked me to read it, she was asking if one of my coworkers was still there, which is a white woman. So I was like, no, she isn't here right now. So I guess that was the reason why she wanted me to know. Take a look at this. So, you know, I just think it's wonderful that this new mayor is going to really help the town get into the mind, thought, and action. And I was like, what? It almost sounded like some Mr. Fuller would say, like, thought, speech, and action. It was something similar to that. And, you know, I read it, and I just put it in the envelope and sent it to the other building. So, yeah, that was some of the interesting observations I had for this week.
Why did that, in the second incident, why did the white woman try to
I guess she was snitching on this other white woman like she was racist about the King Holiday. Why did she do that?
Well, I think, well, they were talking about there was an older white woman that used to be in our department. So I guess it just came up in a conversation. And I think they had problems back, like, a couple years ago when she used to work in this department. But then she got moved, I guess, after so many incidents, and she was, I guess, a problem to some other coworkers. So I guess apparently she was one of them. So I guess, you know, like how it's been shown in a lot of the news segments or past audio segments where you'll have like some white people that'll say, well, you know, I used to date this white person or I knew this white person. He or she said this, and it'll be something that'll kind of contain like racial behavior or racist behavior. So I was thinking about that when she said that. And since I was in, like, I was in the break room while she said this, she referenced my name to say, well, you know, she also said this while I was there, and said that she didn't like the Martin Luther King holiday, and he was just a person that talked and stuff like that. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Mm. Wow. That is, even with that, though, does stand out a bit, at least to me. It's not too often that whites will call another white person, brand another white person as racist. Even in that segment from South Africa that I played during the news clips, where the white guy had been calling the black people kaffirs and all this, you black this and that and the other, he didn't call him a racist. He asked a few questions and what have you and challenged some of the things that he said, but he didn't say, yeah, I think you're a racist. That is generally very rare that they try and suggest that, hey, yeah, this white person is racist. You want to watch out about her. That is just noteworthy. And also I've seen a few times where whites will do that sort of thing to deflect attention from themselves, where they know, hey, I'm white, so I'm racist too, but I will make you think that I am a good white person and I'm down with, you know, you niggers. Dr. King is my man. This Peggy over here, though, watch out around her. She is, you know, a no good racist and so and so. But I'm cool in the game. You don't have to worry about me. I've seen where they'll do that sort of thing as well.
Yeah, that's extremely rare where they do that. They she totally broke cold. And you know, a few weeks ago, Kurt Schilling, I guess he was released from ESPN, and he said, oh, ESPN's a racist company. And I clicked in an article thinking he's going to talk about racism, and he was talking about Stephen A. Smith. So, I mean, usually that's how it plays out.
Come on.
So usually that's how it plays out. So for her to actually put another white person out there, very rare, very, very interesting, man. She's extremely dangerous there, too. I mean, I would stay away from her.
But like I said before, like a couple of months ago, that this was a person who I also strongly suspect was a white supremacist, because I asked the woman, I said, hey, you know, you saying, you know, this word redneck, and you know, I just can't stand them. And then I said, well, you know, such and such, would she be considered one? Since she said this, you heard she said that comment, and she was like, yeah, I heard it. Then so I said, well, doesn't that make her a redneck the way that you're using it? And you should have seen her face. She, you know, she didn't really give a response. She was kind of like stuttering. And this, the same person was saying that when a chair went missing, I believe I shared this, when a chair went missing, I guess someone else had asked me, did I know what happened to it? And I said, I didn't know. And then she said, yeah, because you would have left your blackness all over it.
Dang.
Same person.
Wow. Oh, man. Wow. You got to be careful, because she sounds like she's trying to play up to you and maybe recruit you to get you on her team. But she is a highly refined, but also really interesting white supremacist, boy. She is really something else, but she's dangerous. Really be careful with her. Please do so. It sounds like you are.
Fascinating. Fascinating. The Black Lives Matter exchange was significant as well, I thought. At any rate, as I said...
Hey, Gus, could I...
Yes, sir.
Sorry.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to... last week, I listened to you were talking about... I listen to archives when I can't listen live, and like you were saying how, like, you know, if you just type in N-word, nigger, or N... No, N... I think you said N-word.
Right.
Type in N-word, and you get all these hits on Google. So I typed it in, and it was just all Larry Wilmore. That's all I could find.
He
it
did
was so
the,
funny.
He did the correspondence dinner this past week. I guess it was last weekend, and I think he referenced President Obama as a nigger. Talking about racism, though, he was trying to, in my view, talk reveal truth about racism and how whites see President Obama and that sort of thing. And so people did a big to-do talking about all that, and was it funny? Was it not funny? Should he have done it? Blah blah blah. They spent a whole lot of time talking about that this past week. I suspect if you dig through all of the stuff, I'm sure it'll be troves of stuff on that and the correspondence that are President Obama and all that. I suspect you'll still find a good amount of police officer caught texting N-word here and school person, you know, in trouble for saying N-word in the class. I suspect it'll still be a hefty amount of that. It's just been my observation over the months or so that I've been searching that word on a weekly basis that there tend to be, a sizable amount of those type of news reports on a regular basis where you can just, you can see white supremacy unfolding just around that word alone.
Definitely. Yeah.
With that, we will wrap things up. Again, workplace racism will be moved by June. Next month, we'll move it. It'll be on its own separate day, separate program, and it'll be earlier so people won't have to stay up so late to share to see if that helps facilitate. I want to thank the folks who wrote in. We had both great suggestions for things victims should not do on the job, and then just the honesty, because I think that is a huge part of why some people are a little bit reticent to share about workplace racism and racism in general, just feeling ashamed about, you know, appearing weak or not being able to solve some of these problems on the job. Thank you to both of you. Thanks so much for sharing. I think that is hugely important. Folks can think about that, process on it. If you want to write in your own emails about that or your own workplace racism experiences, feel free to chime in. But I definitely think that's something that all of us deal with to varying degrees, just feeling guilty, embarrassed, ashamed about being victims of white supremacy. And it's nothing to feel guilty about at all. If anything, racists should be the ones who feel ashamed for what they have and continue to do to non-white people, especially black people worldwide. Of course, they do not, but that's the way that it should be. We just, you know, have been terrorized and are just trying to do the best that we can to figure out ways to permanently solve this problem, whites. That being said, again, we'll be back Monday. Joseph Gibson, he'll be here. We'll be talking about his book, How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain. Normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you have questions, problems finding something in the archives, suggestions, gripes, what have you, feel free to just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. I know it has been extremely nice weather up here in the Pacific Northwest. It was in the 80s today. It's getting warmer. Folks want to go outside and do all that stuff. That is great. You still need to remain codified. You do not want to be out and about frolicking in the sun or at the beach or whatever you are doing and think that racism, white supremacy is going to leave you alone just because you're out trying to have a good time and enjoy some sunshine. Not going to happen. Certainly, if you are going to consume any alcohol or whatever the case may be, you need to be codified. If you're going to be in a vehicle, you do not want to be under the influence. That's whether you're a driver, passenger, even if you're a pedestrian. You never know when it will be Daniel Pantaleo, Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, Brian Encinia, any of these race soldiers that pulls you over and decides, hey, I am here to totally ruin your day and or take your life. In those instances, you want to be able to make the best possible decisions. Being intoxicated is going to totally mess that up, and it's just going to make their job 1,000 times easier for whatever they want to do to terrorize you.
Let's just make sure that we are lucid, clear thinking, and in the best position to make fantastic decisions to keep ourselves as safe as possible, and anybody else that you might be responsible for. Certainly buckle up anytime you're in a vehicle. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with enforcement officers. You certainly do not want to be in an environment, in my opinion, where there are white people and alcohol. That is a bad combination anytime, all the time. That being said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.